Okay. Honorable members and members of the staff, welcome to this portfolio committee meeting of today. Today is the last meeting of the term, and we will meet again next year now. I want to thank all the honorable members for cooperation and dedication to their work. I also want to thank the staff members for their support in ensuring the committee receives the report in time. Stats SA has requested to present first due to the commitment they have today. And I have acceded to that report, request. Therefore, they will be the first to present. Honorable members, the National Development Plan states that South Africa needs to focus on building a professional public service and a capable state. This can be achieved by ensuring appointments are purely based on merit from top to bottom. Having said that, though, let me welcome you all to this portfolio committee meeting of today. Let me welcome the Honorable Minister of Public Service, Deputy Minister. Honorable members, I have received some few apologies for today's meeting. I have received apology from Honorable Minister Gungubele, Honorable Ntuli, and Honorable Malomane. I declare this portfolio committee meeting open, and therefore, before Stats SA, I invite Minister of Public Service and Administration to make her opening remarks. Honorable Minister, you can take the floor.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I thought that you would get Stats SA out of the picture, and then I would come in with the issues relating to the entities that fall under me. But I accept with humility your invitation, and thank you very much to you and the portfolio committee for affording us this opportunity to present ourselves before you, so that you would have a better understanding on the work that we do as a department with the various as the ministry and the various entities that you quote directly to me, or have a dotted line reporting to me on certain in certain areas. Today we will be talking about the recruitment and selection norms and standards that will help you to interrogate and also understand where the department is and where the department is going to, and also help you to understand what the National School of Government is doing to support and guide the issues that relate to the selection processes, and also once people are selected, what then happens thereafter in terms of education, training, and development. The Public Service Commission will also come in with the studies that they've done and the investigations that they have done, grievances received, and complaints received around the same topic on recruitment and selection, and what it is that we as the ministry, together with the deputy minister, are going to be doing to ensure enforcement, alignment, and also adherence not only to the norms and standards and the pieces of legislation, but also to the findings of the Public Service Commission, who acts as a, not an oversight body, that acts as a body that assists to determine and also to ensure that we do not deviate from what we do as the ministry. Chairperson, we have the Public Service Act and its attendant regulations that inform the various sections on appointments in the public service. And all this is premised on the following pieces of legislation, which I'll go through very quickly. The Constitution, Section 9, which speaks to the equality, including redress for disadvantaged persons. On the Constitution, Section 195, which speaks to professional ethics, good human resource management, and representativity. The Labor Relations Act, Section 5, Protection of Persons Seeking Employment. The Basic Conditions of Employment Act, 1997, Section 29, Written Particulars of Employment. The Employment Equity Act of 1998, Section 5 to 9, and 20, which speak to the following: unfair discrimination, medical testing, psychological testing, applicant for employment, provision on suitability or the qualification of individuals. The Public Service Act of 1994 has provisions of as organization and administration of the public service and the regulations of employment and the public service regulations, what I had spoken about earlier on, and the collective agreements, determinations, and directives that would be issued by the minister from time to time, some of which would be ventilated and agreed to in the public service collective bargaining council. Where on recruitment and selection in terms of the Public Service Act, we have sections 8, 9, 10, and 11, which provide the foundation for appointments in the public service and also elucidate the need for persons to be fit and proper. We also have Section 12, which deals with the heads of department, both at a provincial and a national department. And these are approved. The process of recruitment and the process of selection is the prerogative of the delegated minister, but approved by cabinet, both for DDGs and also for HODs. But the premiers and the president respectively are responsible for the career incidence of heads of department at a provincial level for premiers and at a national level for the president. The approved posts on the structure must be job evaluated, and as you would know, Section 57.2 provides for temporary appointments additional to the establishment within specific conditions. And there is always an approved structure of various departments, and those positions really emanate from that. But the structure in itself must be job evaluated to determine salary and grading, as well as inherent requirements of a particular job. And this is supplemented by a directive on compulsory capacity development, mandatory training days, and minimum entry requirements for SMS, which set stipulated standards, and this is where the National School of Government comes in. We have various circulars around the issue of recruitment and selection and appointment that have been issued by the ministry over the years, and sometimes tweaked because of the times that we're in, but we're also dealing with the filling of posts in the office of the executive authority, which is done in terms of Regulation 66 and the guide for members of the executive, which is currently under review and is before the president as we speak. On SMS posts, there's a requirement for Nugela, which is a program that has been developed by the National School of Government, which then applicants need to go on prior to an appointment being finalized, and the National School of Government's principal will talk to those issues. There are a few challenges that we experience, such as failure to comply in certain instances, and the employment equity plans, which create challenges in terms of how posts are being filled in terms of the profile of staff, We have a long-standing challenge as a government, but which has a very significant turning on who we are as a society, in that we do not even reach the 3% over the many years that we have been a democracy of employing people with disabilities at the level of 3%. So there are a few challenges that will be dealt with, and the DPSA tries to remedy these from time to time, and there's a continuous advocacy with departments, and as I said earlier on, there are circulars that have been sent to departments on the interpretation of the regulatory framework, and where there are problems, we make sure that departments are assisted in whatever way possible where there are continued problems. Guides have been issued to departments and workshops have been conducted, and all of this is going to be properly ventilated and articulated by the DG for the DPSA, by the DG for the National School of Government, which is the principal, the accounting officer, which is the principal, and also by the DG of the Public Service Commission or the chairperson of the Public Service Commission. Chokerson, thank you very much, and I will then at that point present to you the three portfolios that fall under the Ministry for Public Service and Administration. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Minister. Without any further waste of time, let me now invite the Statistic General.
Chairperson. Chairperson, it's Joe McGlua.
Okay, let me hear you, Honorable McGlua.
Chairperson, my humble apologies. I raised my hand earlier before the minister, but I also didn't want to interfere with the minister's presentation. I just want to raise a point, Chair, concerning the presentations and also the concerns in the past of this committee, as well as the discussion yesterday on the time of these presentations submitted to this committee. We have made a decision that it should be 3 days before this meeting, and I think it is unfair towards this committee to have sent this presentation yesterday. So if it's possible that we can get the reasons for this, and I also think what warrants it, the reason that we received this yesterday, and if not, that the department should render an apology to this committee for the late submission of these presentations. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable McGlua. We will deal with that later on. I have noted your concern, though. Can I now invite the Statistic General? Statistician General, Mr. Maluleke.
Thank you indeed, Chairperson, and let me greet honorable members. I had equally raised my hand when you were taking apologies, Chair, to register the apology of Deputy Minister Thembi Sweya, who is accompanying the Deputy President in Limpopo. But let me mention that the point that is raised by Honorable McGlua is very critical. And there was a bit of a misunderstanding in relation to whether this would serve. As we know, it was stood over last week, pending other processes of briefing our current minister, but we will follow up necessarily through ministerial office to send a proper explanation. Having said so, let me take note of Minister Dlodlo for Public Service and Administration, as well as the Deputy Minister for Public Service and Administration, Deputy Minister Philani Majake, who are leading us this morning there's always a need for that political leadership when we appear as administrators, and at all times, whenever one minister or another is not here, whoever the minister is here, they lead us all. We want to brief the portfolio committee on the African Charter on Statistics. And we are going to look at the background and purpose of the African Charter. We are going to look at issues of ratification, legal opinions and tabling in Parliament, and we are going to go into the next steps. Let me mention, Chair, that the African Charter on Statistics was decided by the heads of state and government in their regular meeting of 2009, where they decided that we will need a charter that has to be open for signature, ratification, and accession by all member states in accordance with their respective constitutional procedures. And why are we bringing it to Parliament at this stage? It's because the African Union, in their ordinances, as well as in their arrangements, is that every now and then, when nations or member states of the African Union take decisions to bring matters of charters or anything, they need them to be deposited to be signed by the executive, but to be ratified by Parliament in the event where there are changes in government and they have previously observed reversals of such commitments by nations. Why the statistics charter? One is because it was decided that there is a need to have base information for purposes of formulation, monitoring, and evaluation of policies based on evidence, empirical evidence. And as such, there was a need to ensure that quality statistics necessary for driving Agenda 2030 and Agenda 2063 is based on empirical evidence. Having said so, the African Charter seeks to address gaps between supply and demand of statistical information needed for the development of the African integration agenda. From a statistics point of view, let me mention that statistical agencies are driven by a global arrangement, that is the United Nations Fundamental Principles of Official Statistics at a United Nations level. At the continental level, the charter then seeks to mimic such arrangements so that those of us who operate within spaces of independence can actually be held accountable within certain principles while we drive the whole issue of evidence-based policy formulation. So on the 9th of September 2015, the ratification process was approved by Cabinet, and following which, on the 3rd of May 2019, a memo initiating the finalization of the process for signing by the President and ratification by Parliament was approved by the then Minister Dlamini Zuma in the Office of the President or Minister in the Presidency. And there was a bit of a lull because the whole issue of dealing with African Union was not institutionalized and had to be addressed first from the side of even our colleagues at DERCO. Having said so, in 2018, in December, the state law advisors from the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development indicated that the charter is in line with domestic laws, and they continued to go further from the side of DERCO indicating that it is in line with international laws. And as such, gave further processes for moving forward. Now, certainly this includes upholding the constitution of the Republic of South Africa. And in 2020, in February, a letter requesting the tabling of the African Charter on Statistics was sent through by Minister, the then Minister Mthembu. And after which, by December, the charter was tabled in Parliament and referred to the Select Committee on Security, Justice, and Justice for consideration. And as such, as of today, we are briefing the Portfolio Committee. It will go back again it will be sent through to the Select Committee of Security and Justice following this briefing today. So, Chair, it's more a process we are making today in line with processes of dealing with the Charter. There are no financial implications for signing and ratification of the African Charter on Statistics. And the next processes or next steps will include the President signing the African Charter on Statistics, where Parliament will formally ratify it and in line with parliamentary processes, and it will be deposited to the to the African Union. Chair, the next slide is the one that I always put here that says, Ngihela kwala, mphelela apha ngalomkhulu mbuliso, I finish here, ngiyaceda khona manje, finish and clear. The next slide should be blank, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, SG. I now want to afford the opportunity to members of the committee to discuss this presentation by Statistics South Africa and therefore adopt it at the end. Can I see hands that want to speak on this report? If you are home and dry, honorable members, just raise your hand to propose adoption of this report by the SG. Honorable Mkweba?
Good morning, honorable chair, the deputy minister, honorable members, and our colleagues. I think, Honorable Chair, the presentation from the States SA is in order, and I move for the adoption of this report.
Can I get a second to Honorable Mkweba? I see Honorable Kibi, Honorable Malatsi.
Thanks, Chair. Oh, okay. You can go ahead, Honorable Kim.
Okay. Thanks, Honorable Members. Thanks, Honorable Chair. Good morning, Chair, Honorable Members, Minister, and colleagues. Honorable Chair, I second the move by Honorable Mkweba. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Kim. Can I hear you now, Honorable Malatsi?
No, thanks, Chair. I mean, this presentation is straightforward, Chair, and it probably breaks the record for the shortest ever presentation by the SG. So I second it, Chair.
Because we will note your secondment to this as well. Thank you very much. We can now release the Start SA team to other commitment that they have. SG, with your team, you are now released.
Thank you indeed, Chair. We thank you very much.
the presentation, Honorable Minister Dodo. I just want to dispense with this query raised by Honorable Mekluwa. I want to say to staff members, it is not, they are always punctual in terms of submitting the reports to us as committee members. But please ensure that everybody else receives these reports in time. Remember, parties want to engage their principals before they come to the policy, to the portfolio committee on the issues that are going to be discussed in the portfolio committee. Please ensure that everybody else receive this report in time. I think I have addressed your concern, Honorable Mekluwa, and I also think that the staff members are hearing the plea that I'm making to them to ensure that everyone receive these reports in time. Thank you very much. Can I now allow the committee to discuss the presentation by DPSA? Oh, who is making a sorry. Why am I so clumsy today? Let me first invite the person who is going to present on behalf of the DPSA to do so.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to honorable members. Good morning to the minister and the deputy minister and colleagues from DPSA and NPSA portfolio. Chair, I understand your confusion. I think that the minister anyway did a better part of the presentation, so I understand your confusion around it's like almost the presentation is done, but I'm going to ask a colleague who will present on our behalf from DPSA, Ms. Renel, who is the Director for Employment Management, to take you through some of the areas that the minister may not have spent much time on them in terms of the presentation. Over to you, Renel. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Renel. You can take the floor.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Minister, Deputy Minister, and Honourable Members. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present to you today. The presentation, I trust that you can see the presentation and it is moving.
Yes, I can see it. It's not moving yet, but I can see it.
Okay, if it doesn't move, Chair, please alert me so I'll stop and we can try and reload it. Thank you very much.
Okay.
In terms of the presentation outline, I think the Minister of Public Service and Administration has already dealt with extensively the regulatory landscape as well as other matters, which I will not focus too much of attention on, but this is basically the outline of the presentation that is going to be done today. The legislative prescripts that's applicable to recruitment and selection in the public service has been covered by the Minister for Public Service and Administration, so I'm not going to spend too much time on that slide. What I will do is I will speak to the specific pieces of legislation that's applicable in the different areas of the value chain that precedes recruitment and that's post-recruitment. So that will create an understanding in terms of the procedures that's linked to the recruitment process when we get to that point. There's various norms and standards to which the MPSA is responsible for in terms of the standard and norm setting, and that's devised in terms of Section 3 of the Public Service Act. And the different pieces of legislation that is referred to that we're going to get to in terms of the value chain, we have to start with the processes linked to our constitutional mandate, which translates into our electoral mandate and our policy position, and then into our strategic plans. So there's specific areas around the human resource planning processes, as well as the organizational structures, that derives the functions of what we need to have in terms of capacity to deliver on those mandates that we are setting. The Employment Equity Act is a very important piece of legislation because that now attributes to how we create the staff profile within the public service and meet those targets that the MPSA has spoken to in terms of the disability targets as well as gender targets. That's very imperative in terms of how we craft our employment equity plan, because that's what leads to how we create the demographic in terms of the public service. And you'll see when we get to the slide on the value chain how important that employment equity plan is in terms of our recruitment processes to avert and avoid challenges when we recruit. In terms of the conditions of recruitment, I think I've touched a little bit on these matters where we have a strategic plan and a mandate, which is derived from our constitutional mandate, our electoral mandate, as well as the policy position. And that strategic plan and mandate then translates into how you should actually procure the capacity for what you want to deliver on in terms of the relevant skills that's required, as well as the occupational categories that's needed for organizational success and for the fulfillment of that strategic plan and that mandate. So the type of capacity you need is then determined in terms of how you then craft your human resource plan. And your human resource plan finds expression in terms of the Public Service Act, where it's derived from, where it's important to determine those occupational categories in order for you to then recruit properly for the purposes of ensuring the right skills and the right fit. And Chair spoke about, you know, the professional public service and capable state and building that in terms of the requisite skills so we are able to fulfill our strategic mandate and plan. Following that, once we've determined what sort of skills we are requiring, and all of these factors that we are looking at here precedes the point of recruitment and selection. So these are very conditional, and the importance of these cannot be stressed, because if we get it wrong here, the chances of how we recruit is then it's inferred, and there's a detrimental effect to how we actually bring in people for the requisite skills. So if we don't get the skill set right in terms of how we determine what should we be planning for in terms of HR, we may not get our organizational structure and design correct. So it's form follows function. So your functions will be determined here. Your form will then be what your structure should look like. And on the basis of that structure, you would then have those boxes populated in terms of the different posts that you would have on a departmental organizational structure. This also finds expression in terms of our Public Service Act and regulations. So it's very clear that executive authorities of individual departments have the authority to align and develop their human resource plan together with their strategic plan, and then determine how the organizational structure should look with due consultation with the MPSA. So the boxes that you will create here will then determine what kind of posts you want to create. And then those posts, in terms of grading and inherent requirements, need to be classified through an evaluation system. So the job is then designed around what you want to achieve, how you set out to achieve it, what are the boxes that needs to be filled to make sure that the structure is aligned to the capacity that we are looking for. The job design is a very important factor in the value chain, because at this point is where we determine the factors that will make sure that the individual that comes into the job is capable and able and fit and proper in order to achieve the tasks that will be set in front of them in terms of the performance management and development system. The employment equity plan, I think I've touched on it already, where you need to determine at this point how you want to configure your staff profile. So if we've got equity targets, it's imperative that a department understands how they want to recruit and the type and profile of person that they are looking for. And that's derived from the employment equity plan. So if the intention is to fill a post with a specific target group, at the point of recruit, before you actually recruit, you need to have predetermined how you want to fill the post, because that's how you would engage the public in terms of an advertisement that will go out to advise them, this is how we are looking to recruit, and we are looking for a specific target for the benefit of fulfilling our demographics as well as our employment equity targets. So all these are the working parts of what precedes recruitment. And as I said, it's imperative to get these working parts of this value chain correct, Because if this is not correct, when you get to recruitment, that's where you find your challenges. And the commission is going to present on various aspects of where the challenges are derived. And I think one of the issues that we need to look at is the coherency of what they've found vis-a-vis our recruitment and selection landscape and framework, and what's not being done to engage properly in terms of the correct fit and the fit and proper persons for employment. In terms of the regulatory aspects, I think Minister also touched on this slide, so I'm not going to make too much reference. I think the one thing that we need to just engage upon here is that posts can also be filled through transfers in terms of Section 14 of the Act, which allows an EA to transfer an individual on an equally graded post from one department to another to fulfill that recruitment requirement, provided that that person actually meets the inherent requirements of the job being transferred to. So we've got a very strict recruitment and selection process, which, you know, is important in terms of the landscape and building a professional public service for the benefit of creating a capable and developmental state. I want to spend a little bit more time on this issue where we look at how we recruit. In our public service, and I just want to skip this one and go to, okay, before we get there. Oops. Let's go back quickly. Sorry about that. As we've pointed out, as ministers pointed out, Section 8, 9, and 10, and as well as 11 of the Public Service Act, builds the foundation for how appointments are to be done in the public service. Specifically, when you look at these sections, they tell you how to fill posts on the organizational structure, which is on the establishment of the department, as well as additional to the establishment of the department. Now, it's very imperative that we understand the difference, because we have posts that's created on the organizational structure through the value chain that was in the preceding slides. And that then determines the permanent structure of the department, where posts can be filled either permanently or can be created on the organizational structure on a contract term. And what's important there is that those particular functions that's created on a contract term may not find expression in terms of the core functions of the department. They could be temporarily linked to a project that needs to be dealt with by the department, and hence they are created on a temporary basis. So people in the public service can be filled into posts on the structure, as well as positions additional to the establishment where a temporary need exists. Now, when we speak about specified conditions, the specified conditions for temporary appointments is usually a 12-month period, and it's derived from the need of a department to actually increase the capacity of the department based on the need for having that additional capacity for a short term. And it shouldn't be confused with posts on the establishment, which are permanent posts on the structure based on a permanent function that needs to be fulfilled by the department. So, for example, during the COVID during this COVID pandemic, departments had to fulfill responsibilities of, you know, having a very clean environment, making sure that employees are looked after in terms of the wellness and health issues within a department. And you might find that a lot of temporary appointments were made of various occupational categories for the benefit of ensuring that that is upheld. And these are not posts that find expression on the organizational structure. These are posts that exist additional to the establishment, usually done because of a specific project. And the issue that comes about here is that the departments often, you know, there's a negative impact in terms of the filling of vacant posts if departments don't utilize that particular regulation correctly in terms of the application of Regulation 57 for a short-term basis. And remember, Regulation 57.2 also makes provision for developmental programs, which includes your graduate programs, which last beyond 12 months, because there's no provision or limitation in terms of that. I think the two-year programs are dedicated to developmental programs such as interns and graduate programs. In terms of the next slide, I think Minister also touched on this one, that we have a directive on compulsory capacity development, mandatory training days, and minimum entry requirements. And this directive was created for the sole benefit of responding to the National Development Plan and the capacitation of senior leadership within the public service. One of the issues that was encapsulated in that directive was the minimum entry requirements for senior management service. And this was about creating consistency in terms of senior management service posts, where there were certain standards that were set with regard to educational qualifications and years of experience that's required at that level in order for job success. And those set standards, you know, in terms of the application of this directive, it has worked because SMS members who found themselves in posts prior to the release of this directive in 2015 may have only had a matric, for example. And when this directive came out, they then quickly realized, my upward mobility is now affected by this. And if I don't actually procure a qualification or manage my own capacity development, my own progressive capacity development, I may not be able to be promoted in the public service again. So it did actually respond to what we are trying to achieve in terms of making sure that the certain standards that have been set is fulfilled across the board in the public service. So if you have an SMS member that's sitting in any department, it would be viable to say that they are qualified in terms of the minimum entry requirements, especially when it comes to educational qualifications. And it was very difficult to say that before 2015, because now we've actually got that standard in place. The job profile determines how a post must be advertised. And this is very imperative. It forms part of the value chain that I initially reflected in the preceding slide. We do a job evaluation process. We determine the inherent requirements of the job. And then we pull that information from the inherent requirements of the job based on what's founded in the job profile, and we advertise to the public. So we tell the public, this is what we're looking for in terms of the fit for this particular post. If you meet these requirements, you're welcome to apply for the post. And posts are advertised in terms of Regulation 65, and it's done in the Public Service Vacancy Circular. It's a very intensive circular that we usually advertise between 250 and 300 posts weekly. The advantage that public service departments have, and this is what we've indicated to them, is that if you advertise in the Public Service Vacancy Circular, you actually do meet the requirements of the public service regulations because it's regarded as a nationwide circular. And there's no cost that's incurred in terms of that process. But certain departments, in terms of the reach and geographic location of certain departments, they also prefer to advertise in the media. But to minimize that cost, we always advise departments, given the fiscal constraints that we're currently faced with, rather save that money and manage it through another function that's required, because the public service vacancy circular, as issued by the DPSA, is a free circular. It's a free advertising mechanism. A 2017 circular advises departments at the PSC, and I think we've touched on that matter in terms of that placement of adverts in that circular. I think ministers also, to a certain degree, spoke to this slide. This is just, I think we want to stress the issue of Regulation 65.9, where we look at the transfer of persons without advertising. So that's the only coherent position where you don't have to advertise a post if you can fill it via a transfer or persons in access within a department. In terms of the norms and standards set in terms of the Public Service Regulations and Act, the filling of posts in the Office of the Executive Authority is done in terms of Regulation 66, and there has been a guide for members of the executive that was issued for the benefit of translating how those posts should be advertised as well as filled on the structure of the department. Regulation 67 deals with the mandatory constitution of the selection committee, and I think it's imperative to understand here that we've got specific requirements for how a committee should be constituted for the benefit of filling up a post, especially when it comes to a director general post, as well as a DDG post, which are cabinet-orientated posts, and those are serving as cabinet. So these are some of the things that we pick up when DPSA follows through on an oversight mechanism in terms of before that cabinet memorandum serves. So DPSA's responsibility is part of making sure these posts are filled, you know, in terms of the fit and proper criteria, as well as the upholding of the requirements in terms of the regulatory framework that passes the DPSA offices before it goes to cabinet to make sure all matters related to the regulatory framework is complied with. Regulation 67.5 highlights the criteria which must be aligned to advertising requirements for a suitable candidate to be recommended by an appointed committee. So it basically highlights the issues in terms of how that should be applied, We also have the issue of the Z83. There's a new Z83 that was gazetted in terms of Regulation 10. And that new Z83 props up various questions in our attempt to deal with various matters that has been raised and lessons learned. The Z83 has been crafted to now acknowledge that upfront, where we are asking candidates to declare whether they're doing business with the state, because there are certain prohibitions for reappointment as well as employment in the public service insofar as how those questions are being answered in that Z83, including your criminal record and whether you have any pending disciplinary action against you. And that facilitates a more coherent mechanism upfront when a selection committee looks at the Z83. And if a person has not represented themselves correctly and there's been any form of misrepresentation, that could lead to a disqualification in terms of the procedures linked to the application process. The shortlisted candidates, specifically for senior managers, and I know that this has also been encouraged for other levels within the public service, must be exposed to a technical exercise and also subjected to a competency assessment, and that's for your recommended candidates. Now, there's a directive that was issued on competency-based assessments for purposes of recruitment as well as development, because it stands firm in terms of how the developmental agenda should be managed for purposes of building a capable state. And one of those aspects is a competency assessment. And the importance of the competency assessment at this juncture of recruitment is to identify any skills deficits that may be found when the person is recruited. And those issues are then streamed into a personal development plan, which then must be responded to through the minimum training days that's required based on the directive that has been issued. So it's a nice balancing value chain from the time a person or pre-employment to post-employment. So we already at the point of recruitment are looking at how we can already start capacitating people, especially with the utilization of the NUKELA. The NUKELA is done prior to the appointment of a person. And the purpose of the NUKELA is to showcase the landscape of the public service. Whether you're coming from the public sector or whether you're coming from the private sector, you can register for the NUKELA and you can actually go through that process if you're interested in applying for a public service post, specifically at SMS level. And what I gather is that the NSG is also looking at mechanisms to filter this down to middle management service as well. So that's the important pieces of processes that needs to be dealt with when recruiting. The other important piece of legislation is 57.1C, which means that all shortlisted candidates must be exposed to the application of personnel suitability checks. And that includes checking whether, and this is forms an integral part of how to determine whether a person is actually fit and proper. And it determines whether a person has a criminal record, whether there's citizen verification that was done. Is this person a South African citizen? Is he a permanent resident? The financial record checks, we want to assess whether the person has the ability to manage their own finances. So if there's an adverse credit record, that is checked in terms of processes and whether or not that will impact on the appointment itself. Because very many people at senior management hold the responsibility of government finances. And you might find that when you look at a financial record of a person, you can gauge the quality of the person on the basis of that. It's one of the criteria that's utilized to actually check what is the background in terms of the person's upkeep with their own individual financial records. The qualifications and study verification, and this is important because the purpose of fit and proper is to ensure that how we advertise is how we fill. It shouldn't be any two ways because that's how you get challenges in terms of a recruitment process. So if we're advertising for a specific post that requires a specific qualification, we need to verify whether the person actually holds that qualification or not and whether it's on the correct NQF level scale as recognized by SACWA. So if the request is that we're looking for an undergraduate and a postgraduate degree, that's something in the fields that's specified in terms of the advert, that's how we should fill. We can't be diversifying and deciding at the point of selection that we want to go back on our criteria because that's not what we advertise to the public. Then previous employment verification, which is your reference checks, and this is very important. You go back to previous employers and you then request the input on the person at hand to look at the integrity, to look at various issues that you may not by yourself pick up in an interview and so forth. So it's an important verification check to actually look at the quality of a person having been employed in a previous employer. The purpose of the exercise is to assess the person against the standards for fit and proper, as I've indicated. And a recommendation is then made by the selection committee to the executive authority following all the processes above being fulfilled. The executive authority approves, an appointment is made. Should the EA not approve the appointment and no appointment is made, and that information in terms of why the selection committee's decision is not considered must be captured on record. So an executive authority has the prerogative to approve or not approve a recommended candidate, because the selection committee remains a recommending body. The EA is still the appointing body, provided that the valid reasons are provided in terms of when a person were to check, why was I not successful? Those reasons must be done through the various pieces of legislation and provided to the individual. Two things can happen if an EA decides not to approve an appointment. You can embark on headhunting, as well as consider the re-advertisement of the post. If that would then create a better pool, it's up to the executive authority to determine which way they wish to go, provided that the reasons are valid for which either one of those options. I want to touch on headhunting because it's often not a practice that's followed correctly by departments. I think there could be a lack of understanding, and this is something we've elucidated in the various circulars that we sent out to elucidate how headhunting should be applied as part of the recruitment process. As we all know, that if I am exposed to a specific process through the normal advertising of a post, anybody who's headhunted for that specific post should also be exposed to the very same process. So the criteria cannot change for the filling of a post, even if you decide to do a headhunting following the closure of your normal recruitment process. I just want to read out section 67.7. It says that if a selection committee is unable to recommend a suitable person for appointment from those who applied in terms of the specific regulations of sub-regulation 5, the executive authority may, after the selection process has been completed, approve the headhunting of one or more persons with the requisite competencies and subject such person or persons to the same selection process of those who applied. So I think that's very clear in terms of how you would then impose headhunting in order to have a successful recruitment process. So in a nutshell, it seems like there's a lot of blocks there, but I think every working part that leads to recruitment is a very important working part. So we've discussed the preceding processes that lead to recruitment, and if we get everything right there, the way we present our adverts and how we communicate to the public will be very clear in terms of what we're looking for, because we've already determined how we want to create the correct match for a person to be appointed into a specific post. Then a person within good faith submits an application. The management of applications are done by individual internal HRs, where there's sifting and sorting and pre-screening. And then an appointment of a selection committee is done by the relevant executive authority as well, or the delegated authority for that purpose. And people are then, when that interview happens, there's a determination of who would be the most suitable candidate. Sometimes in an interview process, you might find that there's certain, there could be only one very good performing candidate that's recommended and nobody else is was found to be suitable. Alternatively, you can get up to three candidates that could be appointable for the post if your first candidate then declines. There's a technical exercise that either is taking place before the interview where individuals are provided with a task and they need to bring that task over when they actually come through for the interview. Or on the day of the interview, which is most of the time, candidates are requested to finalize the technical exercise. And for that purpose, that is basically testing the person's writing skills. It's testing the person's presentation ability. It's testing the person's ability to articulate the regulatory framework, especially if it's a very technically driven post. And then your generic managerial competency assessment is then conducted to determine whether the person has the ability to people manage, has the ability to financial manage, and the various other competencies that's part of that testing in terms of the competency assessment. I've already spoken to the personnel suitability checks. You cannot appoint a person if you have not conducted those personnel suitability checks. So those are done in order to determine whether or not the person as presented and claimed meets those requirements as they've articulated in their CV. A recommendation is made through formal submission, which is the evidence-based administrative process. And then an appointment is approved or either not approved. And as I've articulated earlier, there's different options if an appointment is not approved for whatever reason that's stipulated and recorded as well as documented for the benefit of that department. Minister also touched on the various challenges that impact on the recruitment and selection process. And you'll see from this, some of it is more around things that precede recruitment. Hence, I said, if you don't get the preceding value chain correct, you're going to find yourself in a bit of a dilemma when you get to actual recruitment. So there's a lot of issues around the regulatory framework, which creates investigations and irregular appointments when it comes to irregular appointments. I mean, one issue could be not having the correct delegations in place. And that is improper in terms of how we actually recruit. The issue around insufficient delegations of authority, when there's a lack of delegations, it does have an impeding effect on how we fill posts because it does create delays in the filling of posts based on the insufficient delegations. And then there's not having a proper employment equity and approved employment equity plan in place, because when you get to the juncture of recruitment and you haven't indicated your target audience, your pool is going to look very different when you start to do selection. So it's vital that you actually, before the point of selection and before the point of advertising, have already determined your requirements in terms of your employment equity plan. The issue that comes in here is the selection committee then wants to recommend somebody in terms of the target groups, and it becomes unfair discrimination if you don't have an employment equity plan in place. The other aspect that's also important is that there is restructuring within departments, and the changes, it creates quite a few delays in terms of the finalization and the filling of posts. And these are the realities where you get different departments going through reorganization. And that could be for any reason. You know, I was the HR convener for the National Macro Organization of Government, and you'll see that various departments at that point in time had a specific structure in place. But when these departments merged, you had to relook at how staff could be matched in place, as well as how you can manage the recruitment process when you actually start to merge those departments and start to place those individuals, and then start filling posts that are based on the functional requirements of the department or the new department in that case. I think it goes without saying, we've spoken about the pandemic and how the importance of readjusting work. The DPSA is also for the purposes of trying to manage the recruitment process from the perspective of the applicant. I think it cannot be expected of applicants to constantly go far distances and travel kilometers to actually have their documents certified. We note that, and we take it into consideration. We've issued circulars to say departments should actually limit the engagement in terms of certified documents just to the shortlisted candidates. So it avoids a circumstance where you've got persons in areas where they actually don't have access to actually do an application. So we're very mindful of that in terms of the practicalities on the ground, and we try to adjust in terms of that and issue the relevant circulars to ease the recruitment and selection process, both for the employer as well as the potential applicant. The turnaround time taken by line managers, and it goes without saying that there's a lot of reliance on HR components to finalize recruitment processes, but it remains the individual manager's responsibility to fill a vacant post on the structure. So the line managers of departments must ensure that if a post is becoming vacant or is vacant, they need to initiate the processes with their individual HRs to facilitate those processes to make sure that their post is filled. This is a very proactive process. And if line managers sit back and wait for something to happen, it's not going to happen. So it's imperative that line managers be engaged upon, and we've had various advocacy workshops on this matter and have advised departments in their HR components to do that as promptly as possible. when it comes to, and I think this rings well with bullet one, the HR capacity and the interpretation of the legislation is often lacking. And we've sent out a lot of clarification circulars around the framework and how to interpret. And I think one of the benefits the DPSA has is playing the role of oversight before appointments at BG and DDG levels go to cabinet. What we usually do is we have a capacitation discussion with the department that's submitting a CAM memo. And we often have these advocacy share sessions with them so that they understand how to better interpret the legislative framework. And I found, having worked in this space for quite some time, that the more we've done it, the better departments have become in terms of the application of the legislation. We've had a time where a lot of CAB memos were referred back for correction. But it's the very same departments that we've had those capacity discussions with that are now presenting the best CAB memos that you can ever find, with every piece of legislation being properly implemented. And I think the more we do it, the better we will become. The issue is the movement of HR persons. And I think this is another aspect. And we've advised departments, the moment that your HR capacity changes, please advise the DPSA so we can make contact. We keep a database of HR persons in every department. And when that changes, we want to make contact with the individuals so that we don't lose the line of control in terms of how the legislation is being implemented, especially when we've done all the work to get the previous persons up to speed. There are a lot of deviations, and I think it also links back to the failure to comply with the data-making framework. When there is HR persons that see that the interpretation has not been done correctly, or when there's an issue around having not complied with parts of the regulatory framework, the first thing that departments do is request a deviation. The MPSA does not have the authority to do a retrospective deviation if it's not in the interest of equality. And it's not in the spirit or aligned to the processes of recruitment and selection or any other policy process to initiate a deviation for a lack of having implemented the regulatory framework correctly. So we get quite a few requests for deviations, and we respond to them based on the merits of the case. But as I've indicated, Regulation 4 is very clear that there are certain conditions when it comes to deviation requests, and we've also issued a circular to departments telling them the conditions that should be considered when requesting such deviations. Okay, the other aspect that's very important is where departments continue to fill persons additional to the establishment instead of actually filling their posts in the permanent structure. Where DPSA has gotten sight of that, we always advise departments, listen, your vacancy rate is sitting at this point. And we continue to have this great number of persons additional to the establishment while posts on your structure is not being filled. You need to fulfill that requirement by going through the process of filling those posts, because departments have 6 months to advertise a vacant post and 12 months to fill it. Clearly, there will be limiting factors in terms of whether there's budgetary constraints, whether those posts are still prioritized in terms of the functional requirements of that department. And as we know, there is fiscal constraints at this stage. So departments have been tasked to relook at those processes and then prioritize and update the information on personnel so that the vacancy details is then correctly depicted and not skewed in terms of the percentage that's being reported. I think we've already touched on this matter with regard to the continuous advocacy, as well as the importance of recruiting within the prescripts, which the South African Public Service has a very stringent recruitment and selection process. And I think one of the things that we try to do as the public service is ensure that the best people are appointed into posts with due regard to all the factors that's associated to the various directives, collective agreements, as well as determinations as issued. And these are the factors that we continuously engage on and look for more broader ways of dealing with recruitment and selection, both the preceding processes of recruitment and selection, as well as the post processes of recruitment and selection, to make sure that people are also upskilled once they are in the employer of public service. There are variation of courses that people are exposed to, whether it being onboarding and an induction. So it's about the life cycle of the employee, but recruitment finds itself right in the center of that process. So it's important for HR professionals out there who are dealing with recruitment to actually understand all the accompanying processes that canvas around them when it comes to appointing for correct fit. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity and the privilege to have presented here today. That's the end of my presentation. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. The presentation is now open for discussion. I see Honorable Gibby.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning. Let me welcome the presentation by DBSA, Honorable Chair. My first question is, other than the issuing of circulars, what has or will the department do to ensure the proper application of Regulation 57, Clause 2, so that a vacant post can be filled? Remember, Regulation 57.2 provides for temporary appointments within specific conditions. My second one is, why is there poor HR capacity in departments? Employees that has been hired are expected most to have an HR qualification. This outlines gaps in recruitment process, surely. Where there is poor capacity in HR, are employees checked whether they have the relevant qualifications and so investigate what is the challenge and what is the challenge and are such individuals taken up for e-training, Honorable Chair? And my last one would be, you reported that not having employment equity plan creates challenges in terms of how posts are being filled in terms of the profile of staff. Our understanding was that there was always an employment equity plan in the public service regulating on the appointment of demographics or race, white women, women in senior management, service, and people with disabilities. Please, can you explain that one? I thank you, Honorable Chair.
Honorable Mutsipe.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. My first question is, how do department incorrectly apply regulations 57, section 2, when filling temporary posts, and how does this negatively impact on the filling of posts? And then the other one is, what constitutes a balanced section committee? What are the features? And the last one, sorry, Chairperson. The last one is, since the ZA,
we lost you, Honorable Mutsipe. Okay, we will come back to you, Honorable Mutsipe. We lost you. Let me now call in Honorable Mukweba.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. And let me welcome the presentation by the DPSA. I think, Chair, I've got three questions to the department. One, I've just picked up on the presentation, especially in the slide with the challenges, the failure to comply with regulatory framework. My question for the department is that with the departments that fail to comply, is consequence management applied to those departments? And those appointments that have been found to be irregular, what has been done with regards to them? And the second question, Chair, saying that the department issued guides to remedy the challenges faced, does the department ensure that those guides are properly interpreted with the assistance of the DPME in cases where guides were issued, but no significant improvement that has been made. And lastly, Chair, I think I also picked up in the presentation the lack of standards job requirements for most of the jobs. Then my two questions, Chair, is that why is this the case when the regulations, norms, and standards are in place? And lastly, can this anomaly also be linked to poor performance and service delivery? Thank you very much, Chair.
Honorable Tsipe, have you reconnected now? We lost you. It seems we have...
Honorable Chair, no, I'm covered. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Musipe. Can I now call in Honorable McGlower?
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. And I must say thank you for the presentation. It is quite a mouthful. But I think, rightfully said, our biggest challenge is the execution of these regulations to the T. I've been fortunate to be on the very same portfolio with Minister Dlodlo, and she is quite aware of the problems that we faced in the past pertaining to qualifications. Not only qualifications, but also when it comes to the job required versus the qualification and the regulations, I must say there are sometimes sound contrast between these two, because history also has learned that some of these requirements have been written to fit a specific individual within the organization. Now, my question thus is there any plans from the department to deal with such? Because that really is a problem. We are also aware that most of our institutions are financially strained. And this is a result of incumbents, current incumbents, who is not qualified, who does not know the job, who does not execute their duties properly within the organization. Now, I want to speak to the current status quo in terms of the processes and assessment by the department to deal with those check and balances. I would like a comment as to what is the department doing on the current status quo when it comes to the checks and balances and also assessment as far as those qualifications is concerned. Then again, I might sound difficult. I want to raise again the question in the Northwest Province where an HOD is not qualified. We are now being told that specific case there is now a public protector. My question then, why would a Chapter 9 institution want to go to another institution as far as this problem is concerned? How firmly are we dealing with these issues when it comes to current incumbents, with specific reference to with the issue at hand, where you sit with HODs in our organization that is not qualified? Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Schreiber.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and my thanks to the department for a presentation on a very important and I think often underestimated topic. Chair, I have two follow-up questions. The first one is on this issue of competency tests or assessments that was mentioned. My concern is that I think we have this the wrong way around, because the impression I get is that someone is recruited and then they do this test, and then the test shows areas in which they lack the appropriate skills and should then be upskilled. But shouldn't the test actually be a filter which determines whether someone is appointed in the first place? In other words, the competency assessment comes first, and if someone does not have the required skills, they are not appointed in the first place. The second question, Chair, is regarding employment equity. I've noticed an increasing trend recently of posts that actually remain vacant if these posts are not filled by people in so-called designated groups. I'd just like to get the department's view on this. Is the department in favor of actually increasing vacancy rates if people from designated groups are not considered to be the suitable candidate for a specific position? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I now afford the department the opportunity to respond to all the questions raised. Over to the department.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Honorable Lua Bonawetsan, qualifications on their own do not a good leader make, and I've always said this before, because we then have to look at other attributes that would be required for us to appoint a suitable person that is fit for the job. And we look at many other things apart from just the paper qualification that sometimes a lot of us get fixated on. And I'm not saying that the paper qualification should be disregarded. It is but one of the things that we look at when we make these appointments. And to Honorable Schreiber, the competency assessments are usually conducted before the individual is appointed. It's part of the recruitment process and not the appointment process or post-appointment. It's usually done when the person is still being, when the process of recruitment has not been finalized. I think when the NSG presents, and maybe if the DM would want to come in, over the past 2 months or so, we've had extensive discussions on the issues of qualification versus other attributes and how we should weight the attributes that other people come into the workplace with. We have always, for a very long time, spoken about the recognition of prior learning, which most organizations in the private sector actually accommodate, and it is not accommodated here in the private sector. And that recognition of prior learning is what I think we should also be looking at, and also assisting institutions to assist us to determine at what level an individual would be credited with the type of exposure, the experience, and the many certificates that do not an M27 qualification make. That how, what process should we take as government to ensure that we look into those issues and we do not leave things to chance? On the issue of employment equity, and I think the issue is really about affirmative action, which is a policy of government, by the way, and a hard-won victory by those who put shoulder to the wheel in the struggle for the liberation of our country. Affirmative action, in my view, should never be a negotiable. That's what started. But secondly, affirmative action is not a synonym for non-performance or for substandard performance. You look at very many attributes and an individual is appointed on the basis of that. There are many, many South Africans who qualify for affirmative action recognition, which is part of the policy of our government, than there are those who do not qualify for the affirmative action policy recognition, as it were. So the issue of whether or not we do not fill posts because we cannot find a suitable affirmative action candidate is not necessarily true, Honorable Schreiber. I think at some point we would need to come back to the portfolio committee just to give you, because I've said yesterday to the team that we need to go back and actually determine in real terms, not by way of assumption or suspicion, what are the reasons, because I'm sure there are various, what are the reasons that lead us to having such a high rate of vacancies within the public service, and how does that affect service delivery, but also how does it affect the health and wellness
of employees in the workplace where they have to carry an extra load because a particular function does not have an individual in its place to work in. So there are many things that we need to do to look at why it is that we are unable to fill positions on time. There are many suspicions that we have, but I think we would need to come back to this portfolio committee with a properly worked on document that helps us to understand where the problems are, but not only that, for us to also come back to say to you, this is what we're going to do as a department to ensure that posts are speedily filled within the public service, given the findings that we would have come up with from the investigation. I'm not sure if the Deputy Minister wants to add anything there. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Minister. Deputy Minister, can you come in if you want to add?
Thanks, Chair. I think Minister has really totally covered me. What I'll just generally say is that the one question we need to ask ourselves is, have we got enough policies for public service? Public service are supposed to be efficient, effective, efficient, fair, and really inclusive for South Africans. And I'll say yes. We have beautiful policy documents, but do they actually manage to work for us? They are working for us, but we've got a lot of challenges. So what we're talking about is ongoing process that needs to continue to be evaluated along the way, so that some of the measures that were actually put in place, thinking that they will actually manage to help us to achieve certain goals, and to realizing that they may actually be developing obstacles due to some of the policies. We find that sometimes processes just become disabled because of the fact that we depend so much on policy. We will continue to evaluate so that at the end of the day, we manage to come up with public service policies and rules and regulations that will actually give us a public service that is viable, that will actually manage to respond effectively to the needs of South Africans. And Minister has touched on vacancies, especially at lower levels. We are conscious of the challenge that we've got there. We are going to actually moving on, be looking at measures that are going to be put in place to be sure that those vacant positions, especially for lower positions, are actually filled. There is also an area of contracts, which is a huge challenge because contracts will always be required, but then you find that there will be areas that actually create a problem, in the sense that just the termination of the contract, how you reappoint, whether you advertise, whether we are not at the same time violating the rights of the contract workers, it's a challenge that we need to continue to look at, so that we create a work environment in public service that actually is always conscious of protection of the rights of South Africans. I think for all intents and purposes, Minister has actually covered me, and I would like to just close by saying that we must create a public service that's totally inclusive for South Africans, because South Africans are actually also looking for jobs at all times. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Let me thank the Minister and the Deputy Minister for the responses provided to the question raised by honourable members. Can I now invite the Public Service Commission?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson.
I don't know, your voice is so faint.
Oh,
I don't know whether it's the network on my side. I don't know.
Can you hear me now, Chair?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Chairperson, and members of the esteemed committee, the minister and the deputy minister, and everyone in attendance in this meeting. My name is Anel Ekuria. I'm the commissioner in the Public Service Commission. I'm leading the team that is going to make a presentation. Our presentation will be focusing mainly on the recruitment and selection in the public service, as well as the impact of competencies assessment on the appointment of capable and competent cadres. But it will also try to expose how some of the public servants at the senior management level think about the current processes in the public sector. So we conducted a few studies in line with our mandate of monitoring the personnel practices. I'm sorry, Chair, someone is asking me to share my face. So basically, that's what we will be doing in terms of this presentation. We're giving a summary of detailed studies on this particular issue, but we are giving summary. However, I must hasten to say some of the issues that are contained in our presentation do relate to what was presented by the DPSA. So in those areas, we will, of course, highlight them and just jump them without necessarily dwelling much, because the DPSA has already raised those particular issues. And we just want to emphasize to the committee that it's very important to note that recruitment and selection forms an integral part of the human resource management and development. I have with me the Director General of the Public Service Commission, as well as the Deputy Director General, who was heading this particular study. And she is the person who will be making a presentation in relation to these studies. And also our studies will also reflect, our presentation will also reflect on the number of grievances and complaints that we have received in relation to recruitment and selection in the public service. So as well as the recommendations that we're making as the committee. So Chair, I'm going to give over to DDG Khulufelo Sidibe, Dr. Khulufelo Sidibe. She's the one who's going to make a presentation. And then we will gladly assist with responding to questions as and when the questions are asked. So without wasting time, Chair, I'm going to give over to DDG Sidibe. Thanks.
Thank you. Can you take the platform, DDG?
Thanks very much, Chairperson. Thanks to honorable members. Greetings to everyone, including our minister, deputy minister, and all the other colleagues from the represented institutions. I think, as my commissioner has already indicated, and that the minister and the inputs made by our colleagues from DPSA has dealt with a number of issues that we planned on covering in this presentation. I just want to indicate that our presentation had a particular format, but as you can see on the slide there, in terms of the outline, I would like to go straight into the crux of the presentation, which relates to findings from the various studies that we have conducted as the PSC. To this end, Chairperson and honorable members, I will go straight to slide 15 of our presentation, where we are indicating the first report that we conducted, which dealt with the issue of evaluating the effectiveness of the recruitment and selection processes in the public service. The purpose of the study looked at three areas in particular: whether the recruitment and selection process has contributed towards a broadly representative public service in South Africa, The second being whether the decentralized recruitment and selection processes and methods used in these areas are sufficient to ensure objectivity, fairness, consistency, and quality. And the last one being whether the application of the open competition principle is effective in ensuring the appointment of people with the requisite potential, ability, and fit to impact positively on the performance of the public service. Without getting into the details of what we found in the study, we will provide a summary of the findings as follows. The recruitment and selection process has been effective in ensuring that employment equity is achieved. It's important to look at this given the history of where we come from. The public service was predominantly, especially in the administration, the management, supervisory and leadership areas, was dominated by particular racial groups and gender. And in particular, the representation of people with disability was almost non-existent. So we are saying it has contributed, because when we look at the average national picture, we find that we have improved in terms of the representation of women in various categories of employment in the public service. In terms of representation at SMS, we are fluctuating between 41. Recording
in progress.
Challenged. Yes, it is better than before, but we have not been able to achieve the 2%. But there are isolated departments in various provinces and at the national that have achieved and or exceeded that particular target. In terms of race, broadly, we find that the representation represents the national picture. There might be variations of over and under representation by particular racial groups in certain provinces and or in the composition of national departments, but when we look at the aggregate, it is fine. Therefore, in terms of that, our perspective is that the RNS and its intention of ensuring that we have a representative public service that has taken into account our historic past, it has contributed. With respect to decentralization and the delegation of powers, we do not necessarily think that having decentralized powers contributes towards unfairness and subjectivity in the recruitment and selection processes. I apologize for the unfairness being written as fairness. Broadly speaking, the majority of people who are participating in the recruitment and selection processes, they do what is expected of them. They do follow the Act, the regulations, and all the guidelines, including other prescripts like your employment equity as guided by the plans in these departments. Therefore, our own view is that there is nothing naturally wrong or inherently wrong with delegating powers to multiple recruitment and selection processes, because a lot of public servants do their best to comply with what we have. And maybe if I can use a rule of thumb and say, if we were to look at instances where there is really no compliance based on the numbers of complaints and grievances that we will refer to later, and taking into account the possibility that other people might not necessarily be grieving or reporting their complaints, we do not necessarily think the problems would exceed anything above 3 to 5% of the practices that are out there in the public service. Then what we found being a contributor to challenges in as far as the recruitment and selection and the prescripts are concerned is the lack of standardized job descriptions for most of the jobs, occupations and trades in the public service. We just want to confirm that the DPSA has over the years ensured that there is standardization, especially for program one, which is a program that supports the core functions of most departments, taking into account their varied mandates. But as we go into the specialized areas of departments, in as much as departments differ, there is a sense that there are too many variations, in the sense that an engineer in a Department of Public Works for a particular grade and salary grade, the job specification might be specified differently by that department as compared to another department that is involved in, say, housing or human settlements, where engineers are also required. So when we look at the decomposition of the jobs that we have, or the professions that we have in the public service, they are too many, and some of them cut across a number of departments with varied mandates, but the job requirements for people who are remunerated the same or who perform jobs that are more or less similar tends to be different, and that is what often creates a problem. Then the open competition system remains relevant, and it does enable departments to recruit and to appoint suitable candidates from a wider pool of talent. This, we arrive at it on the basis that the regulations do allow for the recruitment of people who are coming outside of the public service. They can enter the system at any level, middle management, senior, and so forth. Therefore, the recruitment, the open competition, from where we stand as the PSC, we do want to indicate that it is relevant because it allows government to have continuity in terms of the promotion of people who are within the system, but it allows the bringing in of people who are coming in from outside to bring in new ideas, or what we would like to call disruptive innovation, to introduce diversity and so forth. So there is always a need in any system not to lean more towards stability and doing things as we have always been doing, but at the same time, there is no system that can survive if you always want to bring in new people in very, very large numbers, to the point that they are always on a learning curve, and before they can actually even begin to have the impact that you require, they exit, another group of people is required. So there is a need to manage the balance between continuity and new entry into the public service. In terms of the MPSA directive on minimum entry requirements, which has already been alluded to, the study revealed that it does introduce a level of uniformity. And this, again, we arrived at on the basis that prior to this directive, there were instances of people who were job hopping. You will find that an SMS member is appointed in a particular province as a director. Within 2 to 3 years, that person emerges in another province at the level of chief director. I think in the past, not maybe 5 or 10 years back, we have had even worse instances where there were candidates who would move across 3 SMS levels within a very brief period of short years, 5 years. So this particular directive, to a greater degree, it has introduced uniformity, it has reduced unnecessary mobility, where people would be wanting to apply for senior posts before they can even consolidate their experience and expertise at particular performer levels. However, the concern that the PSC is raising, and also that the participants in the study did allude to, is that the emphasis on the years of experience and higher qualifications only as the main determinant for competence, whilst underplaying acquired knowledge, skills and experience, does create a problem. And in this instance, we would like to indicate that the current composition of qualifications tends to be very different from how qualifications were structured, let's say 10 years back. When you go 20 and even 30 years back, they are very different. And it's important to understand that we have career public servants who join the public service, most of them immediately after completing their high school. Some, they came in
as learners and they studied on the job. So those people would have your 20 to 30 years, and some of them would have stopped studying formally for a qualification once they acquired their first qualification, which could have been an NQF 6, a national diploma, public management, or national diploma in personnel management, of which those qualifications are not necessarily there in the current form. They have been decomposed into a whole host of specialized qualifications. So the manner in which this directive has placed emphasis on years of experience being minimum 5, and then you have a qualification which is NQF 7 for SMS, it then does result in a situation where your public servants with the NQF 6 with extensive experience, and some of them would have gone on and did 3 other NQF 6 qualifications. We don't know why they don't go to 7 and 8, but they would have done a lot of continuous development programs. They then get excluded, so that becomes an area of concern. In terms of the recommendations, what we are saying as PSC is that there is a need to identify processes within the recruitment and selection system that can be centralized. And such examples would be standardization of job requirements across all levels, especially for posts that cut across various departments. This will ensure consistency, objectivity, and fairness. However, we are also saying the standardization should not always a focus only on how many years of experience and what is the highest qualification that a person should have achieved. It should also look at other competency dimensions that we are hoping, as we work along with DPSA and the NSG, some of these weaknesses will obviously be addressed. And therefore, the DPSA and PSC, again, should develop a uniform talent management policy or strategy to provide clear guidelines to inform the principles of objectivity, fairness, consistency, and effective application of recruitment and selection practices across the public service. In terms of the second report that we looked at, this particular report focused specifically on SMS members, recruitment, retention, career pathing, and utilization. The reason why PSC did this study is because there was great concern that there is really no a solid framework on how to retain SMS members and how to support them as part of career pathing and how to ensure that SMS members are effectively utilized across the public service. And that would relate obviously with the high turnover rate, where because of those frustrations, people would want to exit the system and then maybe come back later on after 5 or 10 years. So the study really sought to look at this particular issues based on the problem statement, and to also explore whether there is a way in which the public service can put measures in place that will ensure that current and former senior managers' expertise and skills are effectively utilized in the public service. And this is one interesting area that we are aware that the NSG is currently working on, which PSC is quite happy with. And there are working groups, including the DPSA and other institutions in the public service. The first finding. What we found is that amongst SMS members, there is awareness of the framework, and the argument by the SMS members who participated, more than 600, is that the recruitment and selection frameworks and procedures are comprehensive. So they were not necessarily extremely concerned about that part. However, they said there are gaps that need to be filled in this particular framework. And there's gaps. They allude to some of the challenges already highlighted in the previous presentation, including the previous slide. So the HRM framework from where we are sitting, it does not address in a practical way the career pathing, retention, and utilization of SMS members. It is very, very extensive on the recruitment part. And therefore, this is an area where we are saying we need to sort of like expand on it, not just in terms of what we write in black and white, but also in terms of practice, because there are departments that have actually put in place extensive policies in those particular departments to deal with issues of retention and career pathing, but the utilization again remains a problem. And our view is that that particular weakness, it does result in a loss of expertise, inconsistent practices without an overarching framework, and organizational instability or uneven performance. And in terms of the open recruitment system that we revisited again, it was discovered that at the level of SMS, although there is support for the open recruitment system, the view was that it can also lead to low staff morale and organizational stability in instances where people feel that when an employee who has never worked for the public service gets appointed into an SMS post. If I'm a director, I have aspirations of becoming a chief director, and there's only two or three, and maybe those posts are given to people who have worked in the private sector, local government, and so forth. You have then the hopes and the aspirations of a director like myself being shattered. So there is a need to try to strike a balance, but we are of the view that the directive that has been put in place by the DPSA, it does in a sense also address that particular concern. There is also general support. One of the questions we raised to our participants was whether they have aspirations of progressing as SMS members up to the HOD level. The response was very, very low in terms of those people who said they would want to become an HOD. And obviously they made reference to issues pertaining to the high turnover rate at the level of HODs, and the fact that the political administrative interface for many people, it is extremely frightening. I think there's a lot of also misinformation around the political administrative interface. And as a result, this is one of the reasons that would result in departments advertising HOD posts. There might be DDGs that people feel that they are ready, but those DDGs are not even willing to appoint for those posts because they have fears that what if I get given a 5-year contract and for whatever reason the interface, the political administrative interface does not work as planned, and then my contract is terminated within 3 or I get redeployed to another area. But I think beyond that, really, it's just the fear for from many SMS members that to move from a level of DDG where you are appointed permanent to go into a contract post, especially for the younger generation. I don't know what is young. I think most DDGs are somewhere in the ages of 40, 50. But if you still have people depending on you, the fear of moving from a permanent job into a contract that might not be renewed or extended is very high. And that is also one aspect that dissuade people from applying. But there was nobody who said make DG posts permanent. The current methods of appointing HODs, this was one of the concerns that says the involvement of executive authorities. This concern did not come from HODs. It came from the SMS members, including DDGs, directors, and chief directors, who were the majority participants in this area. It was that the involvement of executive authorities in this is seen as a challenge, or it is also seen as a contributor towards the high turnover rate at the level of HODs. Instead, there was a support for what is articulated in the NDP Vision 2020 regarding how HODs should be appointed, the hybrid approach with minimum involvement of political principals. Yes, the appointments should still be in on contract, but the view was if the career incidence of HODs are managed by the head of the public service, which was recently announced in the form of the DG in the presidency. There was a feeling that that would allay a lot of the fears and the concerns that people have about taking up contract posts at that level. And in terms of the recommendations, obviously the PSC has always said we support the NDP recommendations for the hybrid system of managing recruitment and other career incidents. Let me just say, other career incidents, we are referring to things like discipline management, suspensions, and so forth, which at the moment, this basket of career incidents, whilst it is still done in consultation with the president and premiers in the case of provinces, but to a greater degree, the sense that there is great involvement of EAs in that area is a concern. And if these issues are managed by the head of the public service, I think some of the concerns and the fears that SMS members have will go away, or even the wrong information that exists about HOD positions. And there is a need, obviously, to review the HRM framework comprehensively to address the issues of retention, career pathing, and utilization. Let me just say, retention, career pathing, and utilization is not a right. We are not advocating for it necessarily as a right. I think it is the responsibility that the employer has to the employee, but equally, when that opportunity is created, the employee has the responsibility to utilize the opportunities to also develop themselves to the point that the employer is always keen to find ways of retaining them and or utilizing them in multiple portfolios instead of sitting in one area. The review, obviously, it should take into account what has been implemented that we would like to see going beyond the announcement of the head of the public service to a point where there is a well-articulated hybrid process that potentially reduces the role of EAs as articulated in the NDP. And the other thing is that the overarching framework to guide retention, career pathing, and utilization of SMS and expertise and skills in other public institutions across the three spheres of government is absolutely critical. Currently, if there are challenges, let's say, for an example, in a particular municipality or province, it is not that easy to extract the expertise that are required from a particular municipality or national department and send them there. Within national and provinces, it is possible to intervene, but again, you might be having particular expertise that you're looking for that are residing in local government. The current frameworks in terms of secondments and so forth, it does have a bit of a challenge. And we also think that there are people who might have the desire to diversify their experience of being a public servant, not being a public service employee per se. But if they want to go into local government, they must first resign from the public service. And the same applies to local government, but the same would also apply for people who are working with state entities and other organs of the state. So there is just a need to create something that allows for a mobility across so that the public service can tap on skills irrespective of where they are located. The last study that we looked at was recruitment and selection and how it impacts on the functionality of selected national and provincial departments. This was a case study. We were targeting specifically the HR practitioners. What we wanted to check was whether HR practitioners are aware of recruitment and selection prescripts and the policies that apply in their particular departments and what the perceived level of compliance of their departments with recruitment and selection prescripts is, and to also establish and understand whether recruitment and selection practices that contribute to human resource management challenges and how they impact on the functionality of selected departments. This is a study that is largely obviously based on particular perceptions, but the range of participants, these would be people who are in program one, involved in the HR support function of the department. And they could start from your state admin officers up to chief directors and directors, depending on the level of the person heading HR in a particular institution, because it is not the same. In terms of the findings that we were able to pick up, is that some of the practitioners were not aware of recruitment and selection policies in their own departments. And some departments obviously did not comply, as already indicated by DPSA. And part of this could be attributed to attrition rate and the mobility of people as and when they come and go. Hence the importance of what was alluded to by DPSA, that there is a need to continuously retrain and refresh. And a number of these programs are actually in existence at the NSG. It's just a question of making sure that when a department appoints somebody fresh from university, somebody who comes from a state organ or private sector, at least those people should be quickly taken through those particular training programs so they can understand the prescripts fully and the policies of their departments, and actually be able to also determine whether those policies are 100% aligned with the prescripts. And in some instances, what we found is that inexperienced and underqualified individuals are appointed to positions due to non-compliance with recruitment and selection processes. These are the issues that were attested by a range of participants in the study. There are many reasons why this would happen. I think one of the biggest issues is that HR is not able to assert itself. This is an area where HR should have the more say in terms of guiding departments, recruitment and selection policies, and making sure that there is compliance with prescripts, and where deviations are required, they follow the correct procedures of getting approval for such deviations. But obviously, you cannot ask for deviation for each and every post. It has to be isolated instances. And because of that particular weakness with HR personnel, in some departments, or let's say the majority of those that we engaged with, there was just the sense that they are not able to assert themselves. And I think DPSA has also alluded to that, which then raises the importance of continuous employee development. And obviously, once there are problems in the recruitment and selection processes, they do not just end with the process. There is the post-recruitment impact, and this could be employee performance. Firstly, the wrong person can be appointed, but those who are in the department who are observing the process, when they see what is happening, they do get a low morale. And then in other instances, we have strained labor relations within departments. And we are aware that according to HR, there are instances where employees are aggrieved about how certain recruitment and selection processes were conducted and the outcomes, but they do not want to lodge grievances for fear of victimization. Therefore, this is one of the areas that results in grievances and complaints. The last aspect that we wanted to refer to is when recruitment and selection processes are not done properly and people who cannot do the job are appointed, it results in the department pushing the work that those particular officials are supposed to be doing onto the shoulders of other employees who have their responsibilities. And then it results in a case where you have willing horses who are trying to do as much as they can. And some areas they may not necessarily be expert, but they just feel duty bound to do what is required by the employer. And you have these other people who are just hogging along, struggling, simply because from the word go, they were not supposed to be appointed head the prescripts been followed properly. So recruitment and selection, when it is done properly, it will ensure that you do not deal with problems of overloading and underloading. And our recommendations here, it was to say, it's always important to conduct case studies in particular institutions, because when you do surveys that target all departments, you get a broad picture at the high level, but you actually do not get to understand how these problems get to emerge. This is important because departments have got different mandates. They deal with different types of stakeholders. They have different prescripts governing what they do. And those prescripts are not just prescripts that are within the South African borders, but in instances where the country is also signatory to other international protocols and so forth. So it's important to just go into a department and have an in-depth understanding. I think in terms of such case studies, we have done one or two in this previous financial year, but those are still being discussed with the relevant departments. And those in-depth case studies, they are helpful in terms of making specific recommendations that would take particular departments forward instead of just having generic recommendations across the board. Those were really our final recommendations in terms of those studies. Chairperson, I would like to request permission again to skip slides 26 and 27 because the DPSA has spoken extensively around the issue of the competency assessments. Our slides in particular were providing the history of where this competency assessment comes from and how it links up with the other directives that have been issued. What we would like to reflect on starting on slide 28 is what has been observed when PSC itself was conducting other studies within the broader areas of recruitment and selection. Because competency assessment is not a standalone, like Minister said, it's part of a broad range of personnel management or HRM as we currently call it. It's important to always place it within context. It cannot be done independent of all of those processes. It has to fit in and it has to make its contribution. The sense that we got when we engaged, it was that because the current competency assessments are administered by service providers, SMS members who go through this as assessments, especially when they are given feedback, whether they get appointed or they don't get appointed, but when they get feedback and the feedback is comprehensive to be able to guide them on which areas they need to develop their expertise in, they find the competency assessment very helpful. Whilst we are aware that the competency assessment is validated to identify developmental gaps, it's very, very important to note that one cannot ignore the outcome of the competency assessment, especially if in other stages of the recruitment process, the panel has identified particular concerns that they were not sure of. A lot of these issues, if recruitment and selection, especially for people with industrial psychology or psychology and other expertise that enable them to be able to read signs, and when the recruitment and selection is comprehensive, you know, interviewing a person alone is not enough. Of late, most departments, they have written tasks. They give people topics to do, presentations at short notice, because literally this is what is required. And we find that a number of those mechanisms, they allow you to be able to pinpoint whether the person has what you are looking for. But once you pick up concerns in those processes and the person is one of the potentially recommended and the competency assessment comes back and it confirms some of your concerns, you can then say, oh, the competency assessment is validated to identify developmental gaps. It's fine. Let's bring the person in. We will see. No, then at that stage, the competency assessment plays a much more bigger role in terms of informing a part of the decision-making process. But in instances where it alludes to issues that the panel has identified, but it has seen that the person has got expertise in five of the six areas, three of the five, and so forth, you can develop a person, then definitely the competency assessment serves as a very good tool to identify developmental areas that needs to be attended to. And it's important that once developmental areas are identified, they need to be addressed. Firstly, the person needs to be given feedback because there is a view often that when people get appointed, often people think they have arrived. They do not say the panel saw commitment, passion, and what in me, and the ability to learn and to do this, they think they have arrived. If you do not give them the feedback of the competency assessment, you're missing the opportunity, because the deficit that has been identified, it stays with them. And one day they will apply for another senior position. They are taking a deficit into that. And if luck is on their way, they get appointed there, the person enters the next level of appointment, not with a 10, 20% deficit, but maybe with a 30, 40, 50, and so forth. So it's important that when competency assessments are done, people are given feedback, and the department and the employee take responsibility for addressing those weaknesses. And it is important to put a time frame for that. You can't be in a post where you're told your personnel, people management skills are poor, and nobody tells you that you've got 6 months or 12 months to attend the following courses, and we monitor you. And for the next 5 years, nothing has been done again about you. And we wonder why the unit you're responsible for is continuously having grievances and so forth, because the one area that was identified, it has never been addressed by yourself and the employer. So we also think that the 2016 directive on compulsory capacity development that was introduced by the DPSA, and it is now being implemented in practice through Nugela, which is run by the NSG, is definitely one of those programs that seeks to address issues of structured training and at various performer levels. And I think for those of us who know employees who have gone through this program, they really found it to be useful, especially for people who are coming outside of the public service. It is absolutely critical, and the topics that are covered in this, they cannot be taken for granted, and therefore our assessment is that this particular program is helpful. And if I can go to the next slide, the other area that we looked at when we wanted to understand whether the competency assessment framework is adequate, it was to look at what academicians have written about it, but also what various other countries say about competency assessments. Let's say competency assessments are not a holy grail. You cannot expect to fix the problems that you have in a department through a competency assessment. You have to deal with only those that relate to the competence of the person, the group, or the institution through competency assessment. But if the problems come from other areas like your organizational structures or failure to even articulate the HR plan, then the competency assessment framework is not going to help you, no matter how good it is. So it only serves the purpose when it comes in, when everything else has also been done properly. One of the areas that was discovered, by the way, let's say the South African competency assessment framework, the generic, it deals with generic competences. It's very brief and to the point. And on that basis, it is definitely in line with other countries are doing around competency assessment frameworks. And it is better than most of those frameworks that have got a shopping list of competences. And also because the competences are broken into various performer levels. But one of the weaknesses that was identified is that the competency framework would have a one or two liner that makes reference to issues of economic competence and political competence, especially at the senior management level. There is therefore a need to fully articulate what it means for every SMS members to have economic competence, to understand the economic policies of the country, to understand the impact of various economic constraints on what government can or cannot do and so forth. Because in the absence of that, then you have senior managers who are operating from a veil of ignorance. Again, political competence. This is not about membership to a political party. It's understanding starting from your constitution. You know, it's important for people to understand everything that informs the political landscape of the country, why things are the way they are, where we come from, where we are going, and so forth. And on that basis, they are then also able to provide advice that is meaningful to executive authorities. In the absence of that, the advice can, in many instances, tend to be irrelevant, or it may not even address the strategic objectives of the country at a particular point in time. So that area really needs to be looked at. I think in the other areas, we just wanted to highlight that the framework was found to be addressing issues relating to service delivery, not necessarily in a detailed manner, but because it's a generic framework, it was found that it is addressing those issues, plus the issues of public administration broadly in a moderate manner. So there is value in continuously revisiting competency assessment frameworks, but also looking at what other countries and what the experts that support various governments and so forth are saying about these areas. And I think from that particular perspective, the other area that we looked at was whether the competency framework is adequate to get public servants at senior management level to understand what it means to be in a networked government environment. Government is no longer operating like it used to operate in the 1950s, 70s, or even the 90s, where a head of department is responsible for their little department. Head of department is responsible for their department and the rest of the public service. And to a greater degree, most SMS members should be responsible for that. They have a responsibility to support their counterparts in other institutions. They have a responsibility to connect so that government can have a greater impact with limited resources. And one of the issues that we raise is that the current framework does not deal with those particular aspects, but it focuses more on the departmental and the individual, but it does not go into the network or the group or the collective type of leadership that is expected of senior managers in the current climate. So there is a need to address that, but that will only become also real when there are clear support programs that enable people to exit out of the I as the leader to we as the collective, as leaders of the public service and so forth. And having said that, I'm just about to conclude, Chairperson. We just wanted to highlight in terms of monitoring grievances, DPSA has already indicated that when there is something that goes wrong in the recruitment and selection process, you can have labor relations, strained labor relations. And often the only way we pick up on it in a concrete manner is through grievances. And there might be instances of doing or sit-in or go slow, which are not reported in this instance. But in terms of those people who lodge grievances, the graph is very clear that we have had a slight increase. Prior to that, the stats were a little bit higher. They kept on going down or stabilizing. But last year, we saw a reduction overall across all other areas. But in terms of recruitment and selection, we think the reduction would have been also as a result of the fact that not a lot of recruitment and selection happened in the financial year 2020-2021 due to COVID. I think where it happened, it took longer, so which means there would have been a number of posts that were not filled timeously, and DGDPSA has also alluded to that. But 1,325 grievances out of a population of about 1.2 public servants, it's not a very great number, and some of them could easily be repeat grievances by the same person, but yes, we count it as one. So it's a very small percentage, but nonetheless, one grievance can become toxic to the extent that it affects 10 to 20 people. It has to be dealt with properly. And in terms of complaints, again, let's indicate that complaints in terms of recruitment and selection, they are reported by people who are observing, who are not directly affected, whereas grievances are reported by people who have vested interest in the outcome. I am the applicant. I was not shortlisted. I was interviewed, and I hear that I became number one, but they appointed number two. So grievances are lodged by people with vested interest, and complaints are reported by people who are observing. It can be public servants or members of the public. So again, in that particular area, the panel would see that in 2019-20, we had 144, and then we had 112 in 2020-2021. Let me just say with complaints, when we say it's 112 complaints, it doesn't mean it only affected 12 posts. There are complaints that come where the complainant has listed close to 15 irregularities relating to different positions. So the 112 is simply a record of the complaint that we got from the complainant, but it could be implicating a range of other posts. So 24% of the complaints lodged with the PSC, this is the reasons that they were found to be substantiated, and many of the allegations were not substantiated. They were based on hearsay. When we investigate, we have to get information, and the complainant must either be able to provide us with information or refer us to people who will be able to provide with information. But it is, if it is just based on hearsay that Kulufelo appointed her daughter, and you come and investigate in the department and you find that there is no daughter of Kulufelo or cousin or what, again, it becomes those issues that somebody started a rumor, and the rumor all of a sudden became a reality of its own, to the point that it burnt somebody that they had to complain. And so in a number of cases, the PSC would obviously intervene, and where we find that the grievances are substantiated, we do make recommendations for departments to correct. And I think in isolated cases, people have taken issues up to court. And in other cases, departments have actually implemented the PSC's recommendations, which is good. But those things, they do have problems on their own. Whether the recommendation is implemented or not, it's a major problem that needs to be avoided. So appointment irregularities, according to the National Anti-Corruption Hotline, which is where we receive complaints with the PSC, they constitute probably about 8%. And it's 8% of what is reported. But if we take it into the bigger scheme of the numbers of public servants that we have, the percentage is very, very small. Like I indicated, it could be anything between 2% and 3 or 4. And so the factors that contribute to irregular appointments, we have listed them. It's non-compliance with policies. It's disregard of minimum requirements. Once you advertise, you can't say you want NQF 8 and then you go to the panel, you say, no, we want 7 or 6. You have to stick to what you advertise, because the minute you change the requirements, you are disadvantaging people who could have taken a chance on the post had you said, I want NQF 6, and people with NQF 6 said, oh, it's 7, I don't have, I'm not applying. So often when we investigate, we pick up some of this. Then there is poor record keeping throughout the recruitment and selection process, where somebody says, I've applied, but I'm surprised I never received this and that. And when you go into the batch, you find that, yes, indeed, the person applied. Yes, we can screen the CV and say, okay, compared to the appointed person, the person was very far. But we really don't know how the selection committee would have treated your application if it was properly considered and not misplaced. And often you find that there are no comments given for why people are shortlisted or not shortlisted. And people would grieve, because they have the right to be given an answer. Why am I not shortlisted? I was interviewed. Why was I not given the post? So shortlisting panels and selection panels and so forth, they need to record these things and make recommendations with comprehensive information to executive authorities. And maybe executive authorities should return files that are recommending people to be appointed, where information in some areas is very, very scanty. And then in other instances, it's where the job evaluations were not conducted, and then or the compositions were not put on properly, or like DPSA said, sometimes the quickness with which we go into headhunting, we forget that headhunting should also follow the existing regulations. The only thing is that you're not going to advertise publicly, but you still have to subject people to the recruitment and selection processes. You cannot parachute one person without even interviewing and determining whether they are fit for a post and say, there is Kulufelo Chief Director, a policy development, because we did not find the person in the previous. No, the headhunted people must still compete, and it cannot be one person competing against themselves. And not certifying competency outcomes before they were used by departments to make a decision on the suitability of the candidate. This one is found in really, really isolated instances. But it's important to indicate that when an appointment is made and there was no competency assessment done at the SMS level, technically that appointment is irregular. And we do have a guide for departments that deals in detail with these issues and more on how to avoid irregular appointments and how to correct them once you have made the irregularity. And that correction must take into account that if an innocent competitor was appointed, they have protected labor rights. You cannot just get rid of them. That is why the process of correcting that has to include the courts that would determine how the labor rights of that particular employee should be dealt with. But in instances where a person was irregularly appointed and they have misrepresented themselves in their CV, references and everything like that, then there are disciplinary processes and procedures that needs to be followed to deal with that, but it is extremely costly, so it is not necessary to find ourselves in that area. We should just do things right to avoid wasting time, money, and so forth. So emanating really from a number of the TSC just wanted to highlight, this is not the only extensive one that we did. It counted as one investigation, the Department of Public Works, where there were 684 appointments that were investigated. And the PSC is currently, in instances where those they were found to be substantiated, there are disciplinary hearings in progress, and the PSC is required to come and testify. So there have been others that come in groups like that from departments. Within the group, there will be those that are substantiated, those that are not. And obviously, it does take up a lot of time to go through disciplinary. So if we can avoid so that we don't have to go into this, great for everybody. In conclusion, Chairperson, we are of the view as PSC that the prescript governing recruitment and selection, they are extensive. But like we said, the other parts relating to our SMS, career pathing and what it needs to be addressed. But broadly speaking, around recruitment and selection, it is extensive. And DPSA is always continuously trying to address some of the challenges as and when they are brought to their attention. So the implementation of the existing framework really is impacted by the challenges that we have alluded to. The decentralization and the delegation of RS processes to multiple stakeholders, it requires improvement. And one of the improvements we have recommended is the standardization of job qualifications and maybe even the standardization of panels in certain areas. You know, there are instances where you find that panels are constituted by people in the same department who occupy the same level. But what if only one of those people has expertise in the area for which you're recruiting? Take, for an example, IT. So it's important for departments to know that you can't just take somebody because they are called DDG or chief director and make them a part of a panel to appoint a director or chief director IT. You really need your IT gurus. You need to go out and look for those people in other departments, state entities and so forth, so that they help you to get the right people in. While all executive authorities, with the support of the HODs and all officials, have the responsibility to ensure the effective implementation of recruitment and selection processes, they have the recruitment and selection processes in the public service. It is important. Let me read that sentence. While executive authorities with the support of HODs and other officials have the responsibility to ensure the effective implementation of RNS processes in line with prescripts, the MPSA and DPSA, we put stroke, I think Minister, it's supposed to be MPSA, but MPSA is supported by DPSA, is the custodian of the HRM framework. So in the public service, it is important that we don't deal with challenges on a case-by-case basis, but where we pick up systemic challenges that relate to policy or general practice across a number of institutions, we address that in a systematic manner. And the MPSA and DPSA are the most important player in that area through the issuing of directions or amendments of the regulations. And the PSC obviously will continue to monitor and evaluate these important HRM practices in order to identify areas for improvement and to use its findings and recommendations as the basis to engage with MPSA, DPSA, executive authorities of specific departments, HODs, and other stakeholders, such as our practitioners. With those words, Chairperson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, again, in the interest of time, I suggest that we get the presentation by the National School of Government, and then we discuss these two reports together, if that is in order with you. Is that in order?
Yes, Chair.
Is that in order?
Yes, Chairperson.
Thank you. Can I invite the principal of the school?
Honorable Chair, good morning to you and the fellow members of the Portfolio Committee, the Minister, Deputy Minister, and all the colleagues who are here. Thanks for the opportunity for us to come and present to the committee some of the programs that we have been working on, what otherwise we would call flagship programs of the NSG. Now, as the members are aware, there's a lot of programs that we are doing in the Charter School of Government, but for the purpose of this meeting, we thought we should highlight a few that we call flagship, which means they are supposed to be high impact interventions that we either modified in the past year, especially since the COVID pandemic, or that we designed from scratch. I will not be talking about the calls that have been running for a number of years, some of them still very high impact, but I won't be talking about them because they are on the system and the numbers of people who are joining those programs remains very consistent. For example, a range of programs we are doing in the supply chain management environment, where we get orders from departments, or after reading the results of the auditor general, we will go to departments or be called by departments to come and make the interventions. Now, as the members are aware, this is the mandate of the NSG to provide these ETD solutions in the public sector, which means typically in a class at NSG now, you can find a minister, you can find a member of parliament, you can find a councillor, someone from an SOE, and some people from the public administration or the public service as well. And I will demonstrate shortly how we are doing that. We do infrastructure support. I mean, we're going to many strategic planning sessions of various departments where we are helping them with the repositioning processes that are taking place, more so as more departments now are grappling with the idea of how to do planning, you know, HR planning for the future, because they need to be bringing more skills that they never had in the system, more technical skills and digital skills and things like those. This work, Chair and members, is done in the context of the national priority, which is the one of building a capable, ethical, and developmental state. We use this quite a lot in our conversations, because capable state is about the ability of people to do things, which means if you're a Home Affairs official, you are processing death certificates, you must process them diligently and not, and then the ethical part is about making sure that you don't end up harassing a widow who comes looking for a death certificate and you treat that person in an unethical manner when a person is grieving and they want to bury in the day or so. and that must be developmental in a sense that the manner in which we are serving citizens must be developmental, which means it must result in citizens who are satisfied. If we make decisions about building a road, it must be a road that is going to be for the benefit of the people, which is the primary objective of why the state exists anyway. And we are hoping for improved leadership, governance, and accountability, for a functional, efficient, and integrated state, and also to enhance confidence and trust on the state. If public servants do their work diligently and they are ethical, which means they treat people with empathy and they make decisions that are in the best interest of the public, there will be a greater degree of public trust. Which this should be linked. We fortunate that other than the minister and the deputy minister and other colleagues, we also have support on this work that we are doing from the president himself, who speaks about the need to professionalize the public service, and we were given a responsibility to champion the professionalization framework. Now, Chair, this is an important slide because it speaks to our own theory of change, what which we do and what we hope should result in. That when you go through the programs of the NSG, you need to be a committed public sector employee, elected or appointed, because we also train those elected like MPs, MPLs, and councillors, that we must be diligent in the execution of national priorities, prudent in the deployment of public funds. We must be masterful and know what we are doing. So as I said, although it may look like a small, a trivial example, if we are processing death certificates, if there are entries that are incorrect in the death certificate, it may result in a grieving, not being able to bury, because other authorities that are involved in the burial processes may reject the death certificate because it is captured incorrectly. The same goes for a technician who works in a water treatment plant, that if you add more or less chlorine, that will have an impact in the life, in the health of people who will be drinking that water. So the idea of that you being masterful applies to a frontline official, to an engineer in a water treatment plant, to a CFO in a government a department, or even a chief engineer who's designing a bridge somewhere. And importantly, that they must be ethical and accountable to the people. And then lastly, you must be innovative. Innovation matters. So in most of the training programs, the argument around innovation is that if you don't innovate and you say the law says you rigidly read the prescript, you will always be frustrating people. Let me see, through CPSI, our colleagues are not presenting today, some of the innovations that they pick up in their work shows that a manager in the frontline office can sometimes know that where there is a problem here, we don't have sufficient shelter, and they find innovative ways of how they manage a queue. People find innovative ways of how they process permits instead of creating a red tape and slowing things down. So innovation is an antithesis of what people hate the public service for, which is red tape. And you can still be as innovative as you can without breaking the law. So innovation is not about breaking law or flouting rules. It's about finding better ways of serving the public within the confines of the law. So this is what we are hoping will be the impact of the programs that we are doing as the NSG. So members, you will recall last year we had spoken here about COVID and how it was having an impact on us, and we were challenged by the portfolio committee as well as those we serve, which is those who are doing causes with us, that we needed to change the manner in which we are delivering. Historically, the NSG Principal, we have lost you, or you are muted.
You are muted, Principal.
Chairperson, Uchabelonga just speaking from the National School of Government. With your permission, whilst the principal is struggling, I could upload and continue from my side.
Okay, do that, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me upload the presentation from my side.
Are you succeeding to upload on your side?
Yes, Chairperson. I am in the process of uploading. In the current slide that the principal is talking to, he was in the process of sharing some of the challenges that we are having arising from the COVID-19 pandemic and the impact it has had on the work that we are doing. So what I will show, continuing with the presentation, Chairperson, which is now uploading. As soon as you can pick it up, I would really appreciate if the Chair is able to see the presentation. We will then...
It is not yet up.
It is not yet up, Chair. Okay, it's running now. Can you pick it up, Chair?
Yeah, it's still standing where it was.
Okay. The next slide, Chair, after the impact on COVID-19 and open distance, is talking to the issue of our education and training development interventions. If the administrator can download the presentation from the principal, the next slide is talking to our education and training and development interventions. As the principal indicated, Chair, we have a number of programs that we are not focusing on today. At the moment, we have 152 programs, and of those, 21 are higher education approved courses and programs, and we have 54 of those that are ETQA accredited courses and programs, and we have one program which is accredited with the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations. That's the compulsory induction program. So our presentation is not focusing on the 152, but we are highlighting those programs that we've been focusing on in the last year that are much more targeted and much more focused. So we have these functional areas that cover our work, which are administration, induction, leadership, and management. So all these 152 programs fall into these four categories, Chair, and they are linked to the faculties. So we have our faculties. In the next slide, we have the Cadet and Foundational Development Faculty. We have the Middle Management Development Faculty. We also have the Senior Management and Professional Development Faculty, and also the Executive Management and Leadership Support. Some of the programs that the principal was just highlighting are more focused in the last year or so on our executive management and leadership, and also on senior management. These mandated and bespoke programs, Chair, include the one that DDG Sidibe from the Public Service Commission was talking about, UGELA, and we have a number of programs focused on ethics and anti-corruption. We've been running what we call a citizen school on economic governance. We have ETELLA as one of our bespoke programs. mastering the art of execution, something the minister has been passionate about, that we need to focus more and more on the issue of execution diligence. We are also looking at how we support our executive authorities through the chief of staff interventions, and we also have a program targeted at chief information officers. Our flagship programs, Chair, also include gender mainstreaming in the public service. We are also looking at issues of gender-based violence. As you know, we are now in the 16 days of activism against gender violence, and also gender-responsive planning and budgeting. Economic Governance School is the program that we've been running with, which has been very successful, is now in its second year, Chair, and the Adela program, where we also take senior leaders to the simulator so that they can experience the space of leadership and its turbulence and its unpredictability and the requirements that it has on leadership to be adaptable, to be flexible, and to be also be able to adjust. We are also working on, we have this program on socioeconomic impact assessment system. As you know, Chair, with the COVID pandemic, issues of the economy, of unemployment, of poverty, as that essay has been indicating, have become more and more critical to deal with. And we are looking at that in this program on socioeconomic impact assessment. And we make sure that as we move forward, we are able to make sure that all public servants that we're working with can be able to connect to our interventions in as far as socioeconomic impact assessment. Ethics in the public service, Chair, we don't have to repeat. It's an important area that we are working on, which is critical. We are also saying to public servants that they must keep on coming back to the national school to be reoriented, to be cleaned out. The principal is back. We are now on the reorientation program principal, which is now dealing with how public servants need to come back to be reoriented so that they are much more comfortable, they are much more refreshed, and they are able to move forward. Principal, I'll hand back to you.
Sorry, apologies. Yeah, I think I have moved to another data platform. So thanks for that. Yes, so in addition to that, we also have this course called Know and Live Your Constitution, and as well as Nugela. Our colleagues from DPSA as well as the Public Service Commission spoke a lot about Nugela. It began last year, April, on the 1st of April. This basically is what globally is called a government exam. It's a pre-entry government exam, only applied currently to SMS senior managers in the public service. Two things to highlight here, that there is more than 99% compliance. DPSA does monitor this. There is no senior manager appointed to government. Whether you are an internal candidate or you come from the private sector, no one has been appointed to into a position without doing this pre-entry exam. What it does is to prepare people, whether you work in the public or private sector, it takes people through what is required for you to know if you want to become a senior manager in the public sector. This means whether you are a director, chief director, DDG, or even a DG. So all the DGs and HOD appointed after April last year, they had to go through this program called Nugela. It forces people to study about the state and the prescripts of the public service before they can actually be appointed. The one on Know and Live Your Constitution is a critical one, and it's a course that is compulsory, ought to be done by anybody, including members of parliament as well. These courses make sure that even if you trained as an engineer, and that in your training you never encountered even a single day or a second of a module about the PFMA, about the Public Service Act, about the Constitution, you will have to encounter those now in this instance, because the Know Your Constitution is compulsory, and the Nugela is also compulsory for those who want to Nugela or to step up, as it is called, in the public service. Hopefully, it will then be cascaded after a year, we must do a review, another year do a review, and we can cascade it into other levels as well, especially at middle management. So you progressively implement it as such. Now, these are two flagship programs, honorable members, and some of you had raised some questions about this sometime when we appeared before you last year. And we had responded and went to design these courses. The one on the right, we are doing this next week. Last week, a minister for Department of Human Settlement appointed a new board and immediately said they must go through an induction program as a necessary prerequisite for them to do their work. So we're inducting those people, for example, next week through this program on induction. And we've got some of the best faculty, people that we have mobilized in the country who will be doing this induction program. We also have designed a course now on ethical leadership and executive oversight. This course has become more urgent now, given the fact that consistently members of the executive across the three spheres are being, you know, challenged about, you know, whether it is their conduct or their decisions. Sometimes you could buy a car. I mean, we make a case there where a car could be bought for a mayor, and the car could be within the rules. But is it ethical to buy a car for a mayor when there is a need for R1 million to repair a local water treatment plant? What do you prioritize? And we deal with it as an issue of ethics, not just a right or an entitlement. So the course pricks the consciousness of members of the executive across the three spheres so that at all material times they make decisions that are at the best interest of the public. And of course, we also talk to them about the risk associated with reputation damage. Remember, if you are a politician, you know, you have got political capital, and that is the capital that you need to preserve and protect, because it is what you use for you as a, you know, politician to get on in life, in whatever endeavor that you are pursuing. So it is important that it needs to be, you know, protected at all times, and it is an issue of integrity. When executive oversight, we deal with issues like that will be the colleagues from the PSC spoke about. When does doing oversight becomes interference? When does a minister, an MEC, or a mayor, or an MMC know that myself as a DG, I am abusing this thing of the separation or segregation of duties to tell the minister not to get involved, when in fact the minister might legitimately be doing executive oversight? This course is available, and there are provinces that want us to come and train all their MECs, and also in some instances, some of the mayors are already making requests that they would want us to train the executive in municipalities. We've got programs we do with international institutions like ENA, which is a government school in France, one of the biggest government schools in the world, one of the biggest and the oldest. In fact, this is just but an example of the type of programs we do. We also have programs we are doing with the University College London, which is one of the top 10 universities in the world. Just recently, we had a program, this was sponsored by National Treasury, where they took provincial leaders to join this program. And the directors general are part of it, people from the SOEs and so on. So we are growing a bouquet of programs we are delivering in partnership with international universities. I won't say much about this, safe to say that we call it a flagship program because as the NSG, we are leading this on behalf of the MPSA, Minister for Public Service Administration. So the minister, even the minister now at the DM, they are using the portfolio approach to how we coordinate the work of priority one of the sixth administration. We are leading this work. The colleagues from the PSA didn't report on it today, but they are also working on the legislative amendments towards the single public service. All of this work will culminate into major reforms that will transform the public service. On the professionalization framework, which will be presenting the latest version to the minister next week, there are a few things that are being proposed which are consistent with what the colleague from Public Service Commission was speaking about. There's an argument that at pre-entry, we must introduce such things as integrity tests, because police constables are expected to do integrity tests, but DGs they are not expected to do so. CFOs of multi-billion rand departments, they never took integrity test, but to become a trainee in the police service, we are expected to do so. We also believe that the three
Chairperson, if I may continue, since the principal has been cut off again, the point I think he was about to make with your permission, Chair, is that the pre-entry recruitment and selection is also an area that we hope through the professionalization framework we will be able to attend to, and that we will be able to make sure that we have proper systems and processes that are standardized, requiring specific ways to enter public service, requirements for entering public service, and of course some of the issues raised by the Public Service Commission around recruitment and selection, and also our colleagues from the DPSA. These are the five pillars. Of course, then once public servants are inside, we need to make sure that we have proper induction and onboarding. We need to make sure that there is proper planning and performance management. And then we are also looking at this concept on continuing learning and professional development, and whether we should be considering some continuous professional development points for public servants moving forward. And then, of course, the issue of career progression is also important going forward. So these would be the issues that we then deal with as part of our interventions under the professionalization framework that we are talking about. Now, the other issue that we are looking at are the delivery modalities, which, as the principal was indicating, with the COVID-19 pandemic, we've had to worry a lot about open distance learning and how we expand our interventions there. Because with face-to-face training that we used to do in the past, COVID-19 has made that less and less possible. We've also had to introduce over the last year virtual training interventions that allow us to run what we call real-time training, but that happens virtually. So these are the delivery modalities. We are encouraging public servants more and more to come to what we call the simulator, so that they are able to not only learn the theory, but to begin to experience the practicalities of leadership that we were talking about earlier. As a result, we've seen a great deal of uptake in terms of these delivery modalities. You can see, Chair, that currently about 82% of our training interventions are now running online, with face-to-face now at around 12%, whereas pre-COVID-19, face-to-face was our main mode of delivery, and with COVID-19, that has now changed. And these are the stats in terms of the four areas of intervention that I mentioned earlier, how many of our interventions in induction are using open distance learning, how many are using face-to-face, and also how many of those are using the virtual classroom. So the partnerships, therefore, that we are having are allowing us, Chair, to massify rollout and to make sure that our offerings become increasingly available. Of course, we have to take advantage of the digital and online expansion. The issue of the revolving door is part of the professionalization framework. It seeks to take advantage of the revolving door policy that the Cabinet approved in 2006. And how we can make that a reality going forward as part of professionalizing public servants. And of course, we'll have to look at how our interventions allow public servants to be alive to the realities of our communities and how we can be, as public servants, responsive in that regard. These are some of the partnerships that the principal was mentioning. He mentioned ENA. We are running a partnership now with the European Union that is coming to an end in the coming year. We have a partnership with the Civil Service College in Singapore. In the US at Arizona State University, we have a partnership with Standard Bank, and also with the China National Academy of Governance. We have a partnership, and they've been involved in some of our master classes that we've been running. Locally, Chair, we've entered into a partnership with 10 universities in this country of ours, and these are the universities with which we've entered into a partnership that allows us to work not only on the interventions, but also our curriculum and course interventions that we're talking about. And of course, the induction for training of local government councillors is an area that we are focusing on now post the local government elections. And we are hoping that in the next few months, we'll be having some critical interventions aimed at capacitating our local government councillors in this regard. This is the program that we hope to engage local government around. It's a leadership development program, which we are hoping that in the next few months, we should be able to work closely with COFTA and SALGA to roll it out so that we are able to build the necessary capacity at local government. The legislature capacity building program, the chair will be aware of. We've run it in the past with the honorable members, and we are looking at running this same intervention in a way that would allow for a certificate in governance and leadership for honorable members, and also towards some graduate certificate in advanced governance and public leadership for honorable members. These are some of the functional and specialist training interventions that we've not focused on in this presentation around the Municipal Finance Management Act, Contract Management Act, BID committees. These are some of the areas that we are looking at. Project Khayelu, we've spoken about ethics management in local government, and also to make sure that as we intervene, we worry about gender. We also make sure that our foundation management development program is cascaded, including our emerging management development program and also our AMDP program. We have to make sure, Chair, as we intervene in this regard, that also our interventions are responsive in terms of procurement, and then, of course, issues of regulatory oversight and the municipal standard charter of accounts. So these are the areas as we intervene at local government that we will be looking at. We will stop at that point, Chair, and we are open to a discussion. I'm hoping that the connectivity of the principal might improve. We apologize, Chair, for the technical glitches in this regard. Thank you.
Thank you. It is not of your making. We are all experiencing this connectivity problem. I will now welcome back Honorable Tselekulo. I can see that you are back now. You were struggling to log in. I also see that Honorable Dooley is also back in. Honorable members, the presentations are now open for discussion. I can see Honorable Kibi, Honorable McClure after Honorable Kibi.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Let me welcome both presentations. Honorable Chair, mine on the last presentation on School of Governance. The gender mainstreaming in the public service, gender-based violence and gender-responsive planning and budgeting. How is the uptake of gender mainstreaming in the public service, gender-based violence and gender-responsive planning and budgeting? Which department and officials are targeted for this training program? And my next one is on economic governance, spring schools for members of the executive. Is the economic governance spring school for members of the executive compulsory or choice-based for the members of the executive? Has it been taken by the executive so far? Now, Honorable Chair, going to the first presentation, I also have two on lack of a standardized job requirements for most of the jobs. You reported that the lack of standardized job requirements for most of the jobs, occupations and trades in the public service results in inconsistent selection requirements. Why is this the case when the regulations, norms and standards are in place? And can this anomaly also be linked to poor performance and service delivery? And also to the open competition principle needs to be limited to entry-level positions for all jobs, occupations, and trades. You report that the open competition principle needs to be limited to entry-level positions for all jobs, or occupations and trades, and proper management at middle and senior management. Does this mean that middle and senior management positions be internally advertised and strictly within a department, so that applicants outside the public service and outside a specific department should not apply for the position? That is my take, Honorable Chair. Thank you.
Honorable McLuhan and Honorable Nduli after McLuhan.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I want to raise quite a number of issues. I'm aware that you have dealt with the issue of late submissions, but I just want to reiterate that we have just, as a portfolio committee, listened to over 63 pages of a presentation, with which 37 of that was from the PSC. And really, I need to register this. This is the kind of service that we as members of parliament are subjected to by the PSC. One can just imagine what happened in the real world where people are employed without qualifications. Let alone, I think that really there could have been put together better innovation in order to submit these presentations in time. Now, Chair, quite a few years ago, I was the first one to label the PSC a toothless dog. But then Parliament has passed legislation to give them more power. But amid those extension of powers, one cannot allow a organization to grow from a toothless dog to a toothless bulldog. Now, I think the big issue here, and I want to ask a pertinent question to the Public Service Commission, and that is, again, on the issue of appointments without qualifications, with particular reference on the issue of Northwest that I have raised earlier. And I really want the Public Service Commission to state its case as far as its role is concerned pertaining to those. Now, adhering and monitoring as far as the integrated goal is concerned from this organization, it plays a major role, a major part when it comes to oversight and also public administration. And I think the Public Service Commission is the one who's best placed to deal with this issue. But a shocking revelation today, Chairperson, is of one of the slides speaks to the encouragement or rather prevention or rather concern, and actually speaks to the minimum involvement of politicians. Now, I mean, there's allegations of politicians who sent SMSs. Now, what is minimum and what is maximum? Only the presence of a politician when it comes to appointments, it can't be seen as minimum. There must be actually no involvement, Chairperson, no involvement from politicians when it comes to appointments. What happened to the PSC's investigation on the issue of Northwest? Let alone, I must inform this, and I think the PSC is aware of this, that even the military veterans also went to the public protector. Now, what is then the role of the PSC if people within the public service rather find their ways through the public protector? Now, it is time for the Public Service Commission to step up to the plate and also to ensure that effective performance with the values and principles are adhered to as set up in Section 1995. Another thing that has been mentioned and what we, I think we have to be reported here is the follow-up of cases and also the assessments when it comes to recruitment. It has been mentioned that 680, almost 686 or 680 investigations. But what I want to say is that this report does not speak to how these issues has been addressed. So it is important for us as a committee to also get on a regular basis a report on the issues that is outstanding as far as these investigations is concerned. I need some clarity, Chair, on the question of the delegations of powers. I'm not too sure that I hear the presenter right, that delegation is from the PSC to the other respective departments. I need some clarity on that, and also clarity on the open system, where it stated it cannot be fair, and the open system remains relevant. If the open system remains relevant, my question does is, how is it that we have cases of the military veterans as well as a case of the HOD that lands on the desk of the public protector? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Floa. Honorable Ndoli.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I welcome the presentations, but I'll only just touch on one thing on the Public Service Commission, and just two things. I think two things on the NSG. Chair, with the Public Service Commission, I want to check something. Understanding democratic centralism as well as the democratic rights of a person to say, Chair, if you are in a panel, you undergo, let me say you are supposed to go to undergo an oath. I really picked up the format of interviews to say interviews are not only about a lady or a gentleman that comes in and tells us that he was enrolled in the university of Harvard University of what, and that's it. There should be a know-how of what he or she is going to do, and what is expected from that particular person. My worry lies here, Chair, where we've got a report, a complaint, by the way, a complaint from a candidate to say I was number one and I didn't get the job, to say, how can they devise a mechanism that prevents such? Because for me, it's uncalled for. There are a lot of things that are supposed to be looked at the person on the interview. And you can't just be number one or for what you are thinking of as a number one. And secondly, your friend, which is very dishonest, who tells you about what was happening in the interview, will then finalize that you are number one. Yeah, I'm worried about that one. To say, is there any ways and means how this can be prevented? Because these complaints for me are uncalled for. They are very unnecessary. Chair, then NSG, we really commend the Nyugela program, because the Nyugela program gives you the background as to where are you now and what is expected from you. But I wanted to check something in terms of a person entering public service to say, here I am, I've got a qualification in law. Are there any chances of NSG also to develop people in their field? I think it can't be just one person that has studied law and just one person that has studied this and that. But to say, if you've studied 1, 2, 3, that's what we can credit you with, so that you further your course in that field. Let me put it like that. To say, can't they try and open those doors of development as well, whilst starting doing so much work that we really appreciate, and also, Chair, I wanted to check this course that is executive oversight vis-a-vis the performance management. Because it's a good course, I understand, but I'm checking whether we should come up with the purely new course as the executive oversight, or we should strengthen the performance management. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Ntuli. I will now allow the Public Service Commission to respond to the question raised. Public Service Commission first, responding to the question that members have raised, and then the NSG thereafter.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. This is Khulufelo. I will respond to some of the questions, and my commissioner and DG will assist. If I may start with the last comment made about some of the complaints that we get that seem to emanate from gossip.
where a person would know that they were number one in a panel, but they were not appointed. Yes, the reality is we do get complaints of those nature, and when we investigate, one of the issues that we delve into is asking the aggrieved to explain where they got the information and how. Sometimes we discover that some of those complaints, they emanate from people in HR, especially where the positions are for promotions in the HR section. So there would have been weaknesses in the sense that the management of that recruitment process, if under normal circumstances, the particular official is responsible for handling the processing of that recruitment. And in a case where they are competing for a post, there are isolated instances of, let's call it, oversight on the part of the institution to change the process so that the particular candidate gets excluded from the management of that process. But yes, at times information is leaked by officials in HR to line management where the appointments are in management. And we do make recommendations for disciplinary processes to be taken against those HR officials for leaking the information. But also at times we understand that some of these officials are put under pressure by people who have vested interest in particular positions. And if those people are senior SMS members or MMS, you find that they put quite a bit of pressure or a bit of manipulation to extract information. And when we discover that, we also recommend that disciplinary action be taken and that the department should address the issue at the high level, making sure that everybody knows that they are not supposed to be leaking information or demanding information from HR people. So there's a bit of that that needs to be handled as well on the part of HR in terms of HR men, employees themselves knowing that it is prohibited for them to leak information irrespective of whether the person is your friend or not. We deal with those issues on a case by case basis in that manner, but we also recommend high-level interventions to sensitize and to capacitate everybody in the department. The issue of the interview, yes, we've indicated that the interview, it's one of the mechanisms, once you have established the need for a post and you have advertised, one of the steps is interviewing. So what we were trying to indicate is that the interviewing process is not adequate. It's important to have other supplementary processes, and those would include assigning tasks to people on the spot to do certain assignments, giving assignments at short notice prior to the interview. We are aware that a lot of departments do that, and we often recommend that those measures be done, because that is the only way in which you can determine competence instead of listening to a person who knows how to market themselves. Because we know very well that some people are very good speakers, they can market themselves, and other people, they are competent, they can do the job, but they are not necessarily the most spoken. So using a diversity of instruments in the recruitment and selection process, this is what ensures that reliance is not placed on interviews. Even reference checks, they are there, but we also know that applicants can manipulate references in the sense that they can identify people who will say all the best things about them, and people who will say the reality about them might be excluded. So even how the referencing is conducted, it can be done in such a way that information is extracted with immediate effect from the referee, and the person who's conducting the reference check is able to determine whether the referee knows the applicant. So there's a number in the report. We do highlight a number of mechanisms that can be used to augment the weaknesses of excessive reliance on the interviewing process. If I can go on the issue of the 680 something investigations that we did in a specific department. In the presentation, we have indicated we are following up with this department, and with all departments we do follow up, like I've indicated. In the case of this one, which was at Public Works, there are ongoing disciplinary processes for some in instances where panel members were found to have not complied with processes in making sure that the right people are appointed, but in instances where the candidates themselves as well would have misrepresented themselves, those would be some of the cases where disciplinary processes and procedures are concerned. But just to indicate, Chairperson and Honourable Members, there are times where once disciplinary processes are initiated by departments and people know very well that they have a case to answer to and they are not going to escape, other people opt to resign, and the employer cannot stop a person from resigning. And according to the public service regulation, if there is a disciplinary process hanging on your head and you exit the system before it is completed, technically when you want to come back into the public service, we are supposed to reinitiate the process and run with it. Just in the event that maybe the outcome would have been that you should be dismissed. So there are provisions in the regulations on how to deal with this, but there have been, yes, instances where people opted to resign instead of going through disciplinary because they know they are not going to survive. And there are those who just stick in, and at the end of the day, they are dismissed because the evidence is overwhelming against them. But like I've indicated, generally speaking, the majority of the complaints that we get are not substantiated, which therefore means there is nothing to follow up. What we would have done is to give the complainant feedback, or in the case of the aggrieved, we would have given them feedback and to explain whether they have misinterpreted a prescript or whether what they have heard or whatever information they thought they have that tells them something is right, it is not right. So feedback is given in any case, in all the cases. So we do follow up. And in the PSC Section 196 report to Parliament, which we produce on an annual basis, we do also address the issue of follow up on recommendations and implementation. What we do not do is to talk about specific cases with names of people, because people still have the right. I think the legal people, they will say in terms of POPIA, and that we do not have the right to be publishing information that includes people's credentials. But we talk about these issues at a high statistical level without pinpointing people. But from our side and the affected departments, we have the specific information. The issue of appointment without qualifications. If I may clarify, the PSC is not saying we want people without qualifications to be appointed. What we are saying is how we specify the requirement for a qualification needs to be looked at, because it can discriminate against other people. The example that I will give in this particular area, let me take an example of people who have studied what is called now human resource management. Previously, it was called personnel management. So if a qualification or requirement is specified as human resource management, and you have people who have done personnel management with experience, automatically they will be excluded, unless if your selection panel is savvy enough to know that personnel management and HRM is one and the same. And the same would apply. People who would have done personnel management in particular times, they would have also done labor relations as part of personnel management before labor relations became a specialist field. So the caution that we were placing there is that the way we specify requirements for qualifications, we need to take into account that qualifications framework adapt and change over time. In terms of the open competition, again, I would like to clarify, Honourable Member, when we said we want the open competition to be restricted to entry and to be managed at MMS SMS, in the study, one of the things that we were investigating was whether there is strong support for everybody entering the public service at the entry level, and then all promotions should only be earmarked for people who are already within the system. And there was no support for that in the study. But what was supported was that the open competition, it must be at the entry. Basically, what people were trying to say is it is not fair to advertise positions, entry-level positions within departments and not open them up. Because if you advertise it within departments, then it would mean only the employees of those departments have access to the advert and they can alert their neighbors and members of the community. Whereas when you advertise publicly, which is what we call the competition, then anybody can apply for that post. So that was the support to say for entry-level positions, advertise them publicly so that everybody has the opportunity to enter. Do not advertise them in a closed format, because you're closing out on people who do not have contact in the institution. When we said we want them to be managed at SMS and MMS, what we were recommending against was this view that a promotion post must only be restricted to people who are already in the public service. And we have made an argument for that, that it's important for organizations to make provision for upward mobility for those who are in the system, but to keep receiving people who are coming out of the system in order to bring the diversity and the disruptive innovation and so forth that is required by the system. Because if we were to restrict that post at MMS and SMS should only be restricted to people who are in the public service, it would mean people who are in local government cannot apply to come into the public service. So our recommendation is in actual fact aligned with the directives of the MTSA, including at the SMS and HOD level, where it provides that at the HOD you can appoint people who are coming into the public service completely from outside, as long as they have worked for a certain number of years in a state organ, whether it's an entity, municipality, or other agency, and so forth. So I hope maybe that is clear. And then in terms of the lack of standardization for job requirements, what we alluded to as a major concern there is around the technical requirements. It's one thing to have generic requirements that cut across all areas, financial management, people management. But when it comes to issues such as doing the actual job, you want a chief financial officer, you want a person with a policy development expertise and experience and qualifications. Those are the areas where we are saying there are no standardized job requirements. And noting also that some of these professions, they themselves are not professionalized in the same way in which teaching, nursing, engineering and others have been standardized through registration bodies that regulate certain requirements and so forth. So as a result, certain positions, they emerge out of the need for a particular institution to respond to the environment. And because of that, different departments will read the environment differently. They are looking for the same thing, but they will specify the requirements differently. For an example, policy development and implementation, if I can put it that way, you would find that departments would look at it differently. But again, I've given an example of IT, where you will find that when you look at one advert from another department, they might be very different, but all of them, they are actually supposed to be looking for people who will be able to take those institutions forward in terms of the expectations broadly of government when it comes to those issues. So there is no the Public Service Act gives the responsibility for detailing the job specifications to the executive authority of an institution. So there are so many executive authorities, so many departments, and that is the reason why the variation exists. And that is why we recommended that in the recruitment and selection process, we need to be able to identify areas that can be centralized so that jobs that are cutting across and so forth, we can try to standardize the requirements for those the same way that DPSA has done for Program 1. But Program 1 is a support function. It supports the core mandates. But across the core mandates of the various departments, there are still uniform jobs and so forth. I hope I have addressed most of the issues. If I have left anything else, I would request the DG and Commissioner to assist. Thank you.
Is there anything that she did not cover, Commissioner and DG?
Thank you, Chairperson. It's the Commissioner, go ahead.
No, you can go ahead, DG.
Thank you, Chairperson. So the question around effectiveness of the PSC, the legislative review is intended to address the very issue about how effective are we, particularly when implementations are not, the recommendations are not being implemented. So we do hope that we will get the support as a PSC to ensure that the recommendations do get enforced. So the difficulty we have with the view that we are a toothless dog is it's a question of a chicken and egg situation. So do you then lay the finger at the organization because of the way that it is currently structured? Or do we identify where the gaps are then to say, okay, perhaps we need to give the PSC more power in order to ensure that once we've done investigations, we are then able to enforce them. So that's the first issue. The second issue is in relation to why other public servants choose to go to the public protector vis-a-vis the PSC. The general view is that the currently is indeed the overlap of jurisdiction on certain areas between the public protector and the PSC. And certainly members of the public servants are free to choose whichever option an institution they want to approach. However, between ourselves as a PSC as well as a public protector, we have entered into some kind of a referral protocol so that then we are able to manage the forum shopping to ensure that a complainant doesn't come to us, and if they are not satisfied, they go to the public protector. So that's a way in which we try to manage that in terms of the forum shopping of institutions. And the last comment from me, Chair, perhaps is also to extend the apology to members, the concern about the late submission of the documents. We will endeavor next time to ensure that the documents are certainly submitted on time. Commissioner, I'm not sure if there's any other thing you would like to add. Thank you.
Thank you. You can come in, Commissioner Goyer, if there's anything left.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair. No, just two things, Chair. One, just to amplify what the DG has raised in relation to the effectiveness of the Public Service Commission. I just want to remind the honorable members that in terms of the Constitution, as well as in terms of the Public Service Commission Act, our recommendations, unfortunately, are not enforceable. We cannot enforce them. We make recommendations. There's even an allowance for whoever we recommend to, be it the HOD or the executive authority or the DG. they can write back to us and tell us that they will not be able to implement our recommendations and give us reasons. And in most instances, people don't even write back to the Public Service Commission. We write them letters and letters, and we ultimately elevate those things in our reports that we send to Parliament with the view of Parliament helping us to ensure that those recommendations are implemented. So that's what makes us the so-called toothless bulldog in relation to that. But also the issue that was raised by Honorable Kibi in relation to standardization. Our view is that standardization of the job requirements will go a long way in underpinning professionalization of the public service, because that's the direction we are heading towards, so that you don't find the same job that is advertised in the Eastern Cape when it is advertised in the Western Cape. The requirements are not the same, but it's the same job. The job title is the same, but if you look at the content, it's not the same. So that's what basically we were raising, Chair. I thought those are the two things that one just needed to emphasize. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Kloia. Can I now invite the principal of the school to respond to questions raised to the school?
Thank you, Chair. I will do that. I'm just showing. I hope you can see.
I can see what you are flighting now.
I'm apologizing again. I get the feeling that the principal has been cut. He was attempting to respond to the first question as to what has been the uptake with our gender mainstreaming program. So what this slide that is in front of us shows are the numbers for the last financial year when we were first hit by COVID. When we were hit by COVID, our gender mainstreaming programs were run face-to-face because we were quite keen for public servants to be assimilated into the programs. And with COVID, we then had to first work on converting these face-to-face programs into virtual interventions so that we can continue our interventions in this regard. So what the slide that was flighted now shows is that in the last financial year, we were able to train 216 public servants on gender mainstreaming, 84 of whom were males. And of course, national departments were predominant in terms of the number of public servants who attended. This year, so far, Chairperson, we have been able to train 66 public servants on gender mainstreaming. The provinces are coming in strongly this year compared to last year. So we are seeing more and more provinces coming in, and the provincial numbers are beginning to outnumber the national numbers. And we are hoping as we continue this financial year that we will be able to grow our interventions in terms of our development student program. The principal will interject when he's back. The economic governance school, Chairperson, is not compulsory at the moment. Yes, we did take it to cabinet, and cabinet was quite excited and endorsed the program. And yes, we have seen a number of ministers and executive authorities attending. The attendance has been quite encouraging, even though as it stands, it's not necessarily a compulsory program. Chairperson, the third issue that was raised, there was a comment that the Honourable Member raised about Nkela, but then more specifically to say, is there a way in which we could have interventions that would help those who are in specialist areas to further their studies? The Honourable Member made the example of law. Now, that is the issue we are dealing with as part of the professionalization of the public sector. because what we want to be able to put in place in professionalizing the public sector is to enable those employees in the public sector to further their own professional development in their respective areas of expertise. Whether it be through belonging and being members of professional bodies, in which case, once they belong or are members of professional bodies, they are then able to take advantage of the professional development programs and to be able to gain the necessary continuous professional development points in their field of expertise. So that is an important area that the Honourable Member raises, and it's an area that is critical in our professionalizing the public sector. And then the last question, Chair, to ask was really about how we need to emphasize issues of performance management in terms of executive oversight. And yes, that is an area that we will also make sure that we take care of, Chairperson. I don't know whether the principal is back. If not, Chairperson, I will hand back to you.
Principal, are you back? Principal, are you back? It seems he's still struggling. Let me take this opportunity to firstly to thank the Minister of Public Service and Administration and the Deputy Minister for making their time to come and present before this Portfolio Committee. I also want to thank Commissioner Groia and his staff for making sure that they appear before us and present. And lastly, the principal and his staff. Thank you very much. We value your commitment to appear before the Portfolio Committee. As I said in the opening, this meeting today is the last one for the year. So we will draft a new program for the new year and then call the management committee to go through that and then call the portfolio committee to endorse the program for 2022. Thank you very much once again for making sure that you attend this meeting. The meeting now stands adjourned.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you.